running.
I must say, for the record, Minister, we had two late apologies, and they're only arriving a bit later due to buses for some reason. The rest of those who should be here are here. So, while we consider this a very important report and conversation to have with the department, I know that the WHIP will be joining us shortly, and also the another member of the committee. But I think in any event, you have those who will apply their minds and share the information that they gain from this and with their colleagues. I'd like to thank you, Minister Davies, for being here with us, you and your team and the DG, and also to indicate that I think you have all the material you need. We have had the material for some time now. The DG Matona has also enabled us to have this material as well. But to apologize to you, and without saying anything further, to ask you, Minister, to engage with us. It's the opportunity for the annual report and for you to, I know, share with us some of the highlights, the challenges and the achievements here, because we feel we may be able to help you here and there as a committee. So it's over to you, Minister, and at your pace.
Okay, well, thanks, Chair. I see the biblical principle applies wherever two or three are gathered together in our name. It seems to be okay. But thanks for the opportunity. In fact, as you will be aware, the report, as it says there, is for 2008-2009. So it's last year's activities. And the DG will take us through the presentation. I just want to make a couple of introductory remarks, because you will see in the presentation that there were a number of areas of achievement, a number of outstanding challenges, and I just wanted to, as it were, very, very briefly update the picture just by saying that some of the highlights of work which we have been doing and which are beginning to come to their fruition. First of all, the Industrial Policy Action Plan, the next Industrial Policy Action Plan, is now actually pretty close to finalization. We will be making a presentation into the Cabinet Lekgotla next year. And what remains to be dealt with in the Industrial Policy Action Plan is actually just to try to firm up a few commitments from the whole of government on some particular matters, and for us to fill in a few details. But we have the broad sweep of it and quite a number of details in place in terms of sectors and in terms of cross-cutters and things of that sort. The second thing is just to say that the release for public comment of the trade policy paper is imminent, and that will be something which I think this committee may want to consider. Then also on small business and cooperative development, we have been deploying the Deputy Minister, Martin Tooley, together with the team from the Economic Development Division, have been visiting all the provinces. And what we have been asking them to do is to basically, you know, give a good scan as to what the impact of these programs is on the ground, above the sort of high-level kind of reports that you will be seeing now. What is the impact of these programs? We will be engaging with that even this afternoon, and in due course I think we will be wanting to present those findings to you and what that means in terms of how we need to advance our small business strategy. But the one thing I really wanted to highlight actually was over there, the back there, is a new member of the senior team, DDG, Chief Operating Officer Jody Scott. sitting at the back there, who's just come on board very, very recently. And this, I think, is a Jody. And this, I think, is a very, very critical appointment which we've just made. We have had the DG and myself have had a brief discussion with her, and she's been on board about what, a week and a bit, is it, something like that? We've asked her to do a very important exercise, and that is to basically go round the department, and I said the ministry, and even my diary is not exempt from this, and let us look at what kind of proposals you can make to improve efficiency. We're not looking at major structural changes in the department, but we are looking to make incremental improvements. Let's make sure our systems are working effectively. What is not working effectively? Why are the certain number of people on the signing line? Why does it take the time it takes? Is it reasonable? Is it rational? Can it be improved? So we're looking to generate a series of improvements across the department because I think that's a very essential and important part of our work, is to make sure all our services are delivered more effectively, more efficiently, and this is a continuous objective. So Jody is now part of the team, and I think the others, I don't know whether we need perhaps the DG would introduce all the others who are here. I think most of them are familiar to the committee, have been here before. Jody is the new appointment, but maybe the DG just wants to introduce everybody. But I think with those introductory remarks, and of course we're available, I'm available for participating in the questions and answers later on, but I think I'd ask you if we can hand over to the DG to take us through the presentation. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you very much, Minister. Over to yourself, Mr. Matona.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Thank you, Honourable Minister, Honourable Members. Again, we welcome the opportunity to engage with yourself on our work in the context of the annual report, which, as you will see, covers work for 2008 and 2009, but it's work that you have already been interacting with as it has developed going forward. Some of the things that we're doing in 2008, you are already interacting with in this current financial year. As the Minister has indicated, we have a delegation that consists of the Deputy Directors General, in addition to the CEO, Ms. Xavier Karim, and will show their hands or stand up, whatever they wish to do, as I call their names. Iqbal Sharma is not here. I know that he's been represented by Sadiq. He's going to join us later. Kumara Naidu, the Chief Financial Officer. Nimrod Raut, the DDG for Industrial Development. And Sara Chwani, the DDG for Group Services and Support Systems. Sipho Zikode, acting DDG for Economic Empowerment and Enterprise Development. Zodwa Ntuli, DDG for Consumer Corporate Regulatory Affairs. And I know that Lillian Mufukendi, Head of Marketing, is sick. I think she's been represented by somebody, I think Clement. That's the delegation. I hope I haven't left anyone. Tumelo, you were not on my list. Tumelo, very important PDG for the enterprise, what you call the enterprise organization, which is our finance and incentive program. If I just go into the presentation, it's organized in accordance with those topics. We will look at the economic context. We will review our strategic objectives as we had set them for that period. And then we will start to review the performance of the department in relation to those activities. And then we were asked to look at the implications of the medium-term budget policy statement. So we will highlight those areas that have implications for our work in that context. As regards the economic context, we make the observation that after a consistent a period of growth of the economy, in the last year, we have seen a major reversal of our growth. And I think the cause of this being the global economic crisis, which has impacted on the domestic economy, illustrates something which as a department we need to confront, because it'll shape the trajectory of the work of the department going forward, which is in fact the vulnerability of our economy to the global shocks, and it's something which we are attempting to put at the center of our strategies going forward, to strengthen our economy so that we can sustain growth. The figures are there, I think they're familiar. The decline of growth in the first two quarters of 2009-10. We're hoping to the extent that the last quarter figures are lower than the previous quarter, that's the trend that continues, that we're bottoming out. The downturn is bottoming out, and that perhaps sooner rather than later we can resume growth. The areas that have been affected mostly in manufacturing, which are the automotive, is the one sector that has taken the greatest beating, clothing and textiles, capital equipment, metal products. However, in the second quarter, we saw the impact manifesting itself in other sectors that were previously not affected. And those are the chemicals, wood, paper, and other sectors. On the trade front, we've seen a sharp decline of our exports and growth of the trade deficit. All of these, I think, are areas that will experience changes, I think, as time and the economy develops going forward. Another area is employment. Again, the figures are there. A massive reversal of the gains we've made in as far as job creation is concerned. We lost a total of 200,000 jobs between the last quarter of 2008 and the first quarter of 2009. The unemployment rate obviously has increased as a result of that. But the recent data indicates that in the third quarter of 2009, employment contracted by a further 2.6, translating in total into 484,000 jobs lost. Clearly, there are counter-cyclical factors that could assist, and we will be focusing on how we leverage on these. And the leading one is the capital expenditure program, the build program of government, as well as the 2010, to ensure that at least we keep people in jobs and we create new jobs. Going forward, we will also be looking at how we leverage this to advance our work on industrial and development. These graphs are just classic indications of the figures and the factors I have been alluding to starting with the GDP growth, you can see there that the sharp decline, manufacturing decline, you can see there also how the graph goes sharply down. And of course, this is just the current breakdown of performance. And you can see that the metal of iron and steel products leading in terms of the negative impact, again showing our vulnerability in these areas. Here is a graph that shows capital formation mainly associated with the CAPEX program of government, and this is an indicator that we will continue to want to impact on to strengthen the performance of the economy going forward. But that concludes a very brief overview of the economic context in which we undertook this work, and indicating some of the challenges we will confront going forward. The strategic objectives of the department are as indicated. I'm not going to go through them. They indicate the broad, as indicated in this slide, the broad dimensions of the work of the department, with industrial development really being the central focus, almost like the flagship of the work of the department, supported by trade, investment, and export activities around broadening participation, regulation, administration, and coordination. The report, as I presented, will be organized in terms of these headings. In the area of industrial development, our work takes place in the context of a framework, industrial policy framework. And I'm sure the committee will by now be familiar with this document, which basically outlines the vision for industrial development in South Africa, identifies some of the key challenges, key interventions, and then, most importantly, these are specific actions that we are undertaking in regard to different sectors. We had identified a number of lead sectors, automotive components, capital equipment, transport equipment, metal fabrication, plastics, pharmaceuticals, forestry, pulp, paper. Those were the lead sectors that when we started off with this industrial policy framework and action plan, we have targeted. They account for the largest portion of manufacturing. There are a range of other sectoral interventions where we work, which are not receiving the kind of focus in this report. Some of them I'll refer to later on. In the area of automotive, the main focus of the work has been on a support scheme to replace the current motor industry development program, which, as the committee will be aware, is associated with most impressive performance of this sector in terms of export, in terms of production, but which is also associated with a number of challenges. Amongst them being the fact that it has an export subsidy element and therefore is vulnerable. But it's also associated with the massive growth of imports of vehicles. So we have reviewed the sector, reviewed where the problems are and what the sector requires going forward, and have now developed a new program called the Automotive Production and Development Program, which we launched last year. It's got a number of elements in it which we are finalizing now, the regulations around mainly on production incentives and investment incentives. So
But that's as far as the automotive sector is concerned. It is a very central manufacturing sector. It's linked to not less than 12 other subsectors. And hence, it's receiving this kind of focus in our work as a department. If we lose capacity in this sector, then I think manufacturing overall in our country is going to be severely challenged. So it is an important area of focus in the work of the department. Capital and transport equipment and metal fabrication is also a very important sector because this is a sector that gives us the opportunity in the context of the capital expenditure program of government to really create opportunities for manufacturing in our country. And so there are a number of initiatives that we've been undertaking. We're hoping to scale these up. The initiatives in tooling, initiatives in foundry, as well as working with industry associations to identify what are the things that we can do that we have capabilities for that can supply into the CAPEX program. We're also working with the Department of Public Enterprises in regard to procurement programs of some of the key parastatal transmit and ESCOM. In the area of plastics fabrication and pharmaceuticals, we've been working with the Treasury and the Department of Health on how we leverage procurement spend in the area of pharmaceuticals, starting with the massive tender that was issued last year for the manufacture of ARV, which at some point it looked like it was going to be allocated to importers, but our interventions ensure that at least 84%, the majority of the tender is allocated to the domestic industry. It will provide a massive boost to the industry, and we will be looking at other opportunities in this sector, particularly taking into account expected demand in the area of ARVs as our AIDS program unfolds going forward. There are a number of other activities in the area of chemicals, in the area of massive proposed programs by Fasol and Petroza, the project Maputa, and Project Mutombo, as they are called. So we are looking at how we can leverage the industrial development opportunities of these projects. Next is in the area of forestry pulp and paper, where we've been developing a strategy for the furniture sector. Part of this is establishing incubation centers, and we have established one in the Eastern Cape in the period under review. And then a sector which which has been receiving our attention. It is a massive employer and in critical parts of our country, including the Western Cape. And so in the context of the strategy that we developed in consultation with the industry, we have begun to implement some elements of that. We have created incentives promote competitiveness. We started to looking at production incentives. This is the current work. We're hoping to finalize product incentives very shortly. There's also other elements around skills that are part of this work.
other third class, I would like to mention a business process outsourcing, where we have developed the assistance program to incentivize establishment of these facilities. Up to date, we have 17 applications that have been approved, which will create 18,000 jobs and just over $2 billion in investment. I now want to move to a very important area of one of this work, which is industrial finance and incentives, to indicate that we have reviewed one of the largest support programs, enterprise support programs, the department, the so-called small, medium, and enterprise development program, which we reviewed because it already was successful. There were elements in it that were problematic, creating all sorts of perverse incentives. So we have now reviewed this and have relaunched it as the Enterprise Investment Program, which has got two elements. One element to stimulate manufacturing, and this is really for small and medium enterprises, as well as a component dealing with incentivizing technology. It's already up and running and has been taken up by the financial year end. We've already approved 21 projects, both greenfield projects and as well as expansion projects. The features are there in regard to the investment and jobs associated with it. We also have a very important incentive program for infrastructure, and the critical infrastructure program, and in regard to that, five projects were approved with an investment value of $12 billion and 14,000 jobs likely to be created. In film and production, which is one of the newer, very successful incentives of the department to stimulate the film industry, where we clearly have competitive advantage. We have revised the earlier version of this with a view to incentivizing not only foreign production, but also domestic production. And in that context, we have already supported 50 South African productions and 22 foreign productions. And the figures are reflected there again in terms of the investment associated with this. We have been asked to cover the National Industrial Participation Program, and later on there will be much more detail in regard to this. But up to date, this program has created more than 16,000 direct jobs. The number of projects supported is 216. There are still outstanding obligations, but the majority of the obligations associated with this program and the arms acquisition program have been discharged. We are now looking at the next phase of this program, and we've identified some of the changes that are necessary to strengthen the impact of this program in our economy. We have, over the course of the last year, been working closely with the Treasury on a new tax incentive, which is pretty much finalized. The Treasury, a few months back, published a regulation that will govern this incentive program, and we hope it will be launched shortly. A range of other smaller incentives, such as the competitiveness incentive, the competitiveness fund, which we are also reviewing, and we're hoping to relaunch by the next financial year.
as I leave this area, I need to indicate that although the department will continue to explore specific ways in which we can incentivize particular industries, so we will continue to develop customized incentives to target specific market failures. However, the main support for industrial development, the main financing instrument, will continue to be the IEC. So in the context of our intentions to scale up industrial development and our intervention, the IDC will occupy a very important place, and we are looking at how we strengthen the ability of the IDC to support our industrial policy plan. There are other important initiatives which I will just go through quickly. These are what we call cross-cutting interventions in the area of trade policy. There is a strategic framework document which the minister referred to, which has been finalized. And I'm sure we will interact with the committee on that going forward. We've been doing particular import reviews to see how we can leverage import customs duties to support particular sectors of the economy, especially to begin to intervene in sectors that are critical input into various industrial activities, such as aluminium, upstream chemicals, and textiles. In the area of standards and metrology, which are important to ensure that manufacturing performs to the highest possible standards of goods and services, as well as to regulate against dangerous and poor quality products that are taking market share in the domestic market. Two important pieces of legislation were enacted in the period under review, the Standards Act, and as well as the National Regulator on Certification, and this has spawned off a new entity which has just been launched and under establishment. In the area of crafts, the number of activities in different parts of the country, and I did mention the competitive supplier development program, which is a supplier development initiative. Thank you. Sorry about that. In the next slide, we make reference to the National Cleaner Production Center, which is an initiative to promote water and energy efficiency. It's located at the CSIR, supported by DTI. And the numbers I indicated, there are firms that have been audited, and some of them are already implementing some of the recommendations. We did talk about energy. We did, the department, play an important role in the response to the energy crisis, the electricity crisis, at the beginning of last year, together with SADS in terms of standards for various things, including the lengthy fuel, these new energy efficient bulbs, where the SADS developed a standard. And of course, this will continue to be an area that we pay attention to the extent that the electricity crisis is still a major challenge going forward. Next is
industrial development zones. This is a very important part of the work of the department, but one that has challenged us in various ways. And as a result of that, we have done a policy review on this program, which will also deal with issues of governance. Part of the problem has been the fact that all three tiers of government, local government, provinces, the national government, are involved in this program. However, ownership issues are not so clear. There's also a proposal that in dealing with these governance issues, legislation be developed, and the department has started to work on this. Clearly, this will be work that we finalize in the current and next financial year. Some of the established IDZs are in the Eastern Cape, and they are an important part of the Eastern Cape economy. Guha, performance of the two IDZs is indicated there. They are succeeding to attract tenants, notwithstanding the fact that, as you will have seen, the anchor tenant, which was the aluminium smelter, that's on the agenda. And of course, also East London succeeding to attract smaller investors. So this is a program that we need to review to reposition so that it is stable. It's only going to work to the extent that there is a certainty and the incentives that it provides are clear to investors. So it will be a focus of ongoing work going forward. In the area of technology and innovation, we do have a number of incentive programs, the support program for industrial innovation, which is commercialized innovation to the value of 300 million, as well as export sales to the value of 150 million. There's another program called Technology and Human Resources for Industry Program Group, which is really a partnership between universities and the private sector. Also leveraged investments out of 3 million from the private sector. We have a new initiative in the aerospace area, the Chiron Aerospace Village, where we pull together companies in this sector so they can leverage economies of scale, share resources, with a view to becoming more competitive. This is an ongoing project. CEDA has a technology for small technology program for small enterprises. This is one of the successful and very effective programs of CEDA, created 126 SMEs and supported 34 technology transfers to small businesses. Chair, as I indicated, we were requested to include in our report the performance of industrial participation program. And I have tables there that indicate the obligations, the project in which they are involved, and the obligations spent, and the performance. I'm not going to go through this. I'm sure in the discussion, if there are any issues we need to deal with, we can do that. This shows the project, 206 projects that are associated with this program, the geographic square. In the area of trade, investment, and exports,
as the committee will be aware, our strategy has a number of elements. Firstly, to secure market access via bilateral agreements with key partners, both traditional and non-traditional partners. Secondly, the regional integration element of this, focusing on our region, Southern Africa, the rest of the continent. Thirdly, the multilateral element focusing on the WTO and the Doha round. And then, of course, a range of other multilateral processes, such as under the UN, G20, and so on. So those are the elements of our trade strategy. And these slides report on the specific activities that we've undertaken. For example, having negotiated the European Free Trade Agreement with our partners in SACU, this came into force in May of 2008, which essentially concludes the free trade area, or extends the free trade area with Western and Central Europe. These states are those European, important European economies that are not in the EU. We have another important agreement which we concluded with South America, the Mercosur led by Brazil, which also came into force in this year. There are a number of other initiatives we've undertaken to align our trade policy and industrial policy, and the trade policy document which I referred to earlier articulates that alignment. A number of interventions on the continent targeting strategic countries for closer cooperation through trade and investment agreements. Then, of course, in Doha, continuing to work towards a developmental outcome in Doha. In regard to the EU, the economic partnership agreements with the EU continue to be an area of engagement to ensure that we have an outcome that advances our development and the development of our partners in SACU. With India, an important trade partner, strategic partner for us, we have started to raise the tempo of the negotiations for a preferential trade agreement. Two negotiations and sessions have been held already. A number of activities in the context of the African Union to promote continental integration, and in particular, the important focus will be on the proposed SADC, East African Community Commerce Tripartite FTA, which will be a massive advance for economic integration on the continent if we are successful. On the cross-border infrastructure cooperation side, we have these special development initiatives which are ongoing. We're looking at new opportunities in this space, focusing on Angola and Namibia. The work on IPSA continues, as well as on AGOA, which is a very important trade instrument for us, enabling us to export into the U.S. on competitive terms. And then, of course, as I indicated, a number of other activities on the trade front indicated there. the area of export investments, we have reviewed our export strategy. The intention being to target key high growth markets, and in the area of investment promotion and facilitation, again, we have revised our approach. These areas of export promotion and investment promotion really have continuous improvement, learning from experience and trying to adopt best practice methodology. This is work that is led by TISA. A number of initiatives, promotional initiatives have been undertaken in China, India, Russia, the DRC. We have an instrument to support exporters to market their goods called EMEA. It's a very effective, very successful program. We're also looking at supporting smaller exporters. This is a program that CEDA is defining with us. In terms of institutional mechanism, we are setting up a one-stop facilitation. Most economies that are successful in attracting investment are distinguished by the ability to provide very effective support to investors. And so in our context, having learned from some of our weaknesses in this area, we have now established a facility. We should also have a call center to support investors and exporters. This is staffed by people with disabilities located in the way to it'll help us improve our disability indicators in terms of our HR. An important area of this work is the coordination with provinces, and so in that regard we have successfully established a mechanism to coordinate our activities with the provinces. As members will know, the provinces also have competence in this area, and they have these investment promotion entities. The last but one bullet indicates that we have set a massive and ambitious target for investment, but with the current global environment, clearly we will not be able to achieve that target. We have a network of offices abroad that are instruments of promoting both investment and exports. I now move to the area of foreign participation. And here, the work has revolved around the codes of good practice and these sector charters. Those sector charters that have been concluded have been converted, and in those sectors that are indicated there. Another important area of this work has been the alignment of the provisions of the BEE Act and the Code of Good Practice with the Preferential Procurement Framework Act of the Treasury. You members will be aware that the Treasury published regulation that seeks to amend the provisions of the guidelines in as far as procurement is concerned. We hope that that work will be finalized in the outcome released soon. In the area of the measurement of BEE, our work has been focused on accrediting these BEE verification agencies. This is an industry that has developed quite spontaneously.
So to standardize practices here, we are providing a certification service. Lastly, the very important part of the dispensation on BEE, the advisory council on BEE, which is provided for in the Act, we are close to finalizing the list of possible names for this advisory council. It is something that the presidency is leading on. The Act says that the advisory council will be started by the president. We did some work in identifying candidates, but the presidency is finalizing this, and I'm hoping that shortly we will have the council announced. Gender and women economic empowerment is a very important focus of our work on foreign participation. We had established a structure called the South African Women Entrepreneurs Network, Section 21 company, really largely an initiative by the women entrepreneurs themselves with our support. We're looking at strengthening this and repositioning it so that it's a lot more effective. There are other separate initiatives in this area. For example, the Women's Fund, which we have launched in partnership with the private sector. That's about to take off. There are other incentives that the department has to support the BEE and women enterprises, the Black Business Supplier Development Program, which assists companies to access business development services, has grown quite massively. It's very, very popular, very successful initiative. We are reviewing it so that we can target Black SMEs more effectively. I did mention the Leader Technology Program and the Innovation and Human Resource Incentive earlier on, so I won't spend too much time on that. The important area in this slide is the incentive program for cooperatives. We have begun to dispense support to cooperatives, particularly in rural areas. 93 cooperatives have been supported, and the sectors in which they are operating are indicated there. Our agencies as well are playing an important role in supporting cooperatives, SumUp, Leader, and CoLab. In terms of outreach and communication, we have undertaken targeted communication activities through radio, television, print media, 109 events, exhibitions, and individuals we've held to promote the uptake and awareness of DTI products, media briefings, and radio programs, television, and then television programs. I want to move to another important area of our work, which is regulation. To indicate that we undertook a massive legislative program focusing on four bills, all of which were passed in Parliament and have actually been signed into law by the President in the area of companies, consumer protection, competition, and gambling. Another piece of legislation that we were not successful in putting through simply because of the
the agenda of Parliament being crowded, and we will be introducing it in this current Parliament, is in the area of intellectual property and really the protection of indigenous knowledge. I think we're going to engage with the committee on this legislation. We are doing regulatory reviews focusing on estate agents as well as on gambling and liquor. And then, of course, in the area of consumer redress, we continue to process consumer complaints. This area will clearly be strengthened by this new legislation on consumer protection. And I'm sure members are aware that we are already promoting awareness of this legislation. And we'll be doing the same with other legislation. I want to come to the area of administration and coordination. And here, just to highlight that our focus has been on strengthening our capacity as a department, particularly in regard to human resources. It's been an area of challenge for a while, particularly in regard to vacancies, but we are already beginning to make inroads against the challenge. We've reduced the vacancy rate from 25% in the previous financial year to just over 18% by 31st of March 2009. We are looking at other initiatives to give us a proper handle on this area, focusing on talent management, performance management, training and development, and retention. The rest is detail on some of the activities we've undertaken in this area. We try and, as a department, also promote compliance with particular targets in regard to procurement and targets in regard to HR. And those are the statistics in regard to how we stand in regard to employment equity. 82% of our total staff are black, 59% are female, 41% women in senior management level, 1% disability, we're still behind in terms of the target disability target of 2% there. And as I indicated, our procurement targets, SMEs, as well as EEE, women enterprises, and people with disability. These pie charts represent the same information, so I'm not going to spend too much time on this. I want to come to a very important area of corporate governance to indicate that we have a structure for governance, the executive committee of the department, we call ESPO. We have an operations committee, audit committee, risk management committee. We are trying to ensure that risk management is an integral part of our overall management of the department. And we've undertaken a number of training interventions in this area. Finance is a very important part of our governance. And we are pleased that we're still sustaining a track record over the last 5 years of unqualified audits. This year, our under expenditure is the lowest in the last 5 years, sitting at 1% of our budget.
see that in the period 2006, 7, 8, our budget had a significant increase, but started to level off in 2007 and 8, and in fact is on the decline. Yet this is in the context of clearly increased demands on the services of the department, both in regard to enterprise support, industrial development. This will be something that receives our attention. Obviously, we're mindful of the difficult fiscal conditions we're currently confronting at the moment. However, we believe that the department's work is critical in contributing to overcoming the impact of the recession. So this will be a very important area of engagement by the department with the treasurer. This is the structure of the TGI budget. 78% consists of transfer payments to our agencies, IDZs, and other transfers. 54% to incentives, 7% to compensation of employees, and 10% for goods and services. That 10% for goods and services is really that part of the budget that allows us to undertake discretionary activities and new projects in accordance with the priorities as they emerge. We also work in the economic cluster, in fact it's now called the economic employment and economic sector cluster. We have been the co-coordinator of the cluster. It's a very important instrument for achieving coordination of our work with the work of other departments. We will continue to focus on ways to strengthen the effectiveness of the cluster. Our modus operandi involves very intensive consultation through NEDLAC, as well as through other forums, more sector-specific forums through which we consult. As I draw to a conclusion, we were asked to reflect how the medium-term budget policy statement will affect our work, and there in this slide is reflected some of the areas in the medium-term budget policy statement that will have implications for us. Some of them we are already doing work along the lines that have been indicated in the budget statement. For example, changing the orientation of industrial incentives to focus on labor-intensive industries. This is something that's very important to us. We are continually looking at how the suite of incentives can, in fact, better impact on employment. So it will continue to be a very important area of focus of our work in terms of industrial finance and incentives. R&D. To support job creation, clearly our industrial policy framework document identifies this area, and we will be working very closely with the Department of Science and Technology in this area. Rural development, clearly this is an area which is part of our cluster program of action, and as a department we have an important contribution to make in rural development in terms of rural enterprises, and a number of our sectors that are based in, such as forestry, for example, that are based in rural provinces. Competitiveness and productivity, as well as export performance, are clearly important areas that we cover through our incentives and through our industrial sector interventions, such as those I've indicated at the beginning of this report. Utilizing trade, industrial, and competition policy to create jobs. Again, members will be aware that, especially when it comes to competition policy, that we've seen quite a very impressive improvement in enforcing competition policy, and I've indicated with the legislation that has been passed, which will strengthen the ability of the competition authorities to combat anti-competitive behavior. Growth opportunities in Africa, this is related to our trade strategy, which has a very important component focus on the continent. And I have spoken about our work on investment, rationalizing public entities. This is a very important area of focus where we seek to ensure that the entities under the department are aligned with the priorities. So it's something which we will continue to give ongoing focus on. We've spoken about the review of procurement, and again, that's something very important for us, and we will continue to work with the Treasury in that space to ensure that we leverage procurement to achieve some of our objectives. In conclusion, Chair and members, I do want to say that in as far as the activities that we had planned for the year under review, our objectives and plans for the year under review, we've made progress. Clearly, a lot of this work is ongoing work, and of course, in that context, we do have challenges of ensuring that we continue to improve our impact, we continue to improve processes within the department, structures of the department, and as the Minister referred, we are hoping that having brought on board the Chief Operating Officer for the department, this will give us the ability to make advances and in tackling some of the operational and performance challenges. Finance will continue to challenge us, particularly in the context also of the recession, reduced revenues. And the HR challenge clearly will continue to be a central challenge that we will continue to focus on. I will leave it there, and thank you for your attention. And then, of course, we can deal with some of the questions that the committee may have. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Minister. Thank you very much, DG Matona, as well. And what I'd like to do, I may have just seen a couple of members leave, just to assist for 5-10 minutes somewhere. And we'll be back by 10. It's now 5 to 10. So we're just taking a very short break of 4 minutes. Anyone who wants to take some tea may, because there's no tea now. After that, you'll be getting tea when we finished. So, comfort break and everything, 4 minutes. Thank you. are, all these constant so-called breaks and everything. We're back on track. Once again, thank you very much, Minister. Thank you, DG Matona. And it's over to the Portfolio Committee. Perhaps rather than a few preambles, because they're quite aware of what our backgrounds are, can we just move rather swiftly into the questions or make a comment, of course. And we'll take 5 questions or comments. Honourable Mabasa, Honourable Maria, Honourable van der Westhuizen, Honourable Ntikalana, Honourable Turok.
Chair, when you said 5 hands, I immediately said, if I don't raise my hands now, it means this train is going to leave me. My first question is, I don't know whether from DTI's point of view, DTI will see it as a micro question, but the consumer protection, how well are we doing with that body? I'm saying this because South Africa is one of those countries in the world that are west, where consumers are taken advantage of. And of course, that relates to our history. So that if we just leave it to the wisdom of the consumers to utilize the tool, the tool may be there and not be utilized by the most needy people and only be available to those that are empowered. Then my second question was that on page 14, or slide, is it slide 14 or 12? But I will quickly see. Yes, yeah, on slide 14, on the performance of the NIPP geographic spread of projects, I do notice that there are some provinces that are almost not there, you know. They are just popping up their heads. So are there any strategies of working on such? Because I take it our success is going to happen if it happens nationally. Then the last one is on cooperatives. To say what percentage out of the overall support that goes to various enterprises, what percentage is going to cooperatives? And the outcomes, are there mechanisms of properly measuring the outcomes, so that we don't stop at saying 3 cooperatives are there, but we don't measure what comes out of them, as well as far as they purchase from government, what is that term again, procurement. Do they procure with government? Thanks. Or the disabilities, I just noticed it's 1%. It's worse. So a serious comment on that area.
Thank you, Honourable Mabasa. It leads very nicely on to Honourable Maria.
Thank you, Chair. I will only ask the first round 4 questions, but it might be slightly longer than you anticipated. My first one is I just want to give you a couple of information, you know, in terms of perceptions, and then, you know, I would like the response from DTI. We need to generate more forex revenue via exports and FDIs especially. We need to add more value to our resources before they get exported. In other words, that is where we can get job creation and obviously higher value forex earnings as well. We know that the South-South relationships and strategies are very, very important. But currently, we also know that on South-South, we've got a trade deficit. In other words, in a very simplistic way, the more we promote that, the bigger the deficit is that must be funded. North-South, it seems like, is of a lower strategy or strategic value than South-South. But we know that the EU is still one of the biggest trading bloc partners, if I can call it that. And we know that we have got a trade surplus from North-South relations. So in other words, more value-added exports, more jobs that are created sustainably as well. What does the DTI do or suggest or plan as an urgent measure to increase value-added exports to especially China, Asia, India, that part? Because that we know that in terms of consumer and potential consumer demand, that is where the big market is. But we know that there is little or no value-added exports to those markets. That's the first one. Then in terms of the MIDP, and I'm going to play a bit of devil's advocate, we know that is primarily auto manufacturers, motor car vehicle manufacturers, and obviously component manufacturers. We know that the majority of those motor car manufacturers or vehicle manufacturers are foreign owned. We also know that the retail side on the auto industry, the service side, and the spare part manufacturers has got more employees than the manufacturers alone. And we also know that dividends are flowing out from profits earning by these companies. So again, in a very simplistic way, it seems like taxpayers is funding the profits and dividends flowing out of the country. Your comments on this will be much appreciated. And also, you know, what is the budget for this program? And how does the DTI balance this very important program, in my opinion, with the benefits and especially the forex and sustainable jobs that we must earn from that, if you understand my question. So somewhere there must be a balance and there must be a break-even point that you go through and say, hey, we're scoring from this. The third question is on problems that some industries are experiencing, and I'm naming only two: textile industry, which includes clothing and shoes, and the aluminium extrusion industry, where we know that complaints that I have heard is obviously imports from China, where it is subsidized products in China. And obviously where they claim that it is unfair competition with South African manufacturers and that in the process, you know, jobs are losing and factories are closing down. I know that some of these industries have had discussions with the DTI on this. And you know, how do you intend assisting these industries? You know, would it be by way of, again, increasing tariffs, which is contrary to the WTO, initiatives and sentiments? Or will there be other incentives? And how will you deal with those WTO complaints in that regard? And then fourthly, it's on the EPAS. We know that there's been discussions that you've had, Minister, with Namibia. The perception that one gets from certain sectors is that what is currently going on with regards to the EPAS can damage SACU and that damage can be extended into SADC, into a block on the one side and some of the other members that lines up with the European Union. Can you give us more information in that regard? And you know, because somewhere South Africa must play a major role in consolidating what is going on in SADC, but it also seems like, you know, we're not quite sure on which side of the fence we want to find ourselves. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. No, I did allow that because they were all relevant and important, but I hope that precedence won't be taken there. Honourable Van der Westhuizen.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think the fact that the previous two members did not congratulate the department on its unqualified audit is probably because it's accepted as the norm in this department. But may I then just say thank you and congratulate. We also believe it's not really something to congratulate people on if they just meet the requirements, but it has become in South Africa quite an achievement, apparently, for government departments to achieve that, and I would really like to convey my congratulations. Also for the fact that there's a continued trend of meeting the requirements. I think that is really a feather in the cap of this department, and I would certainly like then from my side to congratulate the department. There are, however, a few things that the Auditor General has mentioned as in need of attention. I see there's reference to leave that have not been captured regularly, and that record keeping in terms of leave is not to his liking. Also, that the human resource plan was not in place for the major part of the financial year. Now, it seems to me, if you say for the major part of the financial year, can I then just get the confirmation that my deduction is correct, that it's now in place? Then also on page 188, there are a few key governance responsibilities where it seems to me as if there's some need of attention. Especially on page 189, there's a reference to something which disturbs me, and that is the department did not have adequate systems to maintain the safekeeping of all documentation. Consequently, documentation requests for audit purposes was not always made available timelessly. I also noted that management did not put measures in place to monitor adherence to policies and procedures relating to financial reporting and compliance with applicable laws and regulations. And I would please, I trust that the relevant officials have paid much more attention to this report and that they've already given it some thought, and I would love them to share this, these thoughts with us. If I can stick with that for the time being, Madam Chair, I'll appreciate some response in that respect.
Thank you. Useful to also get the page numbers. Honourable Chikalana.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, let me preface my input by saying that I suppose some of my questions will be in writing later, because I've already been intimidated that it is expected I've got a long list of questions. But also I would echo Honourable Van der Westhuizen's input around the department's report, though I'll have quite a number of questions. And also, when I looked at it, it's markedly different from the previous report. It's intimidatingly thick. But just as a comment as well, the fact that the performance information has been included has been very, very helpful. I won't even finish it. I think it's very, very helpful, and it will be our Bible throughout the year, even when we go into the presentation of the forthcoming financial year plan. All I can say is it would be helpful maybe that we explore inclusion in the performance information, the component or a section of impact assessment. Already from Dr. Matuna's input, Chair, some reference to impact assessment has been done, and of course in some of the activities that has been done, but if it could be done as a norm, you know, to everything. The first thing I was keen on, Chair, was the agencies, because they report to DTI through the various divisions. A lot of talk has been done around the need to rationalize the agencies, and it would be just interesting to get to know whether DTI has applied its mind on that, and to what extent. And the question links to also some curiosity around restructuring. Earlier this year, when we asked the question around restructuring vis-a-vis the Department of Economic Development, it was said come October. Now October has come and gone, Chair. So it would be helpful for us to get to know how far is the restructuring and what impact is it having on DTI. Furthermore, coordination, to an extent, reference is made, but my question here on asking details of this is premised on the fact that even in the last term and earlier at the beginning of this term, we've been very emphatic about intra-COTI coordination. And one of the things we'd like to get, I'm sure my colleagues would be very keen on that, is the impact of the coordination, not the impact of SAMAF only, not the impact of NEF only, but when the team works as a conglomerate, because SAMAF starts from 50 to or 20 to 10,000. Kula takes off from there, DTI goes on, and NEF is on the side lines, and there could be a few others. Then when these agencies share work as a team, what impact do they have? Well, I'm very cautious that also that they're not the only players in the economic industry, but still, it would be helpful to know what the extent to which we are able to get to know any or analyze any impact thereof. The DFI, Baba Turok has been emphatic in the past about the fact that we need to ensure an additional investment or cash injection of DFIs. I think it would be helpful just to get from DTI as to what is the position on that, given the need that we've got an industrial policy, we've got an economic crisis, which has triggered a lot of thinking on how to handle our economy. But obviously, I'll be quick, Chair, to say that whatever question I'm asking, at the back of it, or linked, or ancillary to it, is that I'm mindful for the fact that one would expect a consolidated performance management system as well. In other words, you don't just give additional money without ensuring that there is some performance management arrangement. But my insistence is that does DTI, what is its position on ensuring that the DFIs, you know, get additional cash injection? It links with another question, that how do we ensure the critical mass in the various programs? I was watching, Chair, with great admiration on the various projects around broadening participation. But unfortunately, the numbers on the ground, you know, what has been done on SMEs, they're very low. So a question triggers to me, how do we make sure that these numbers are large? Is it because the level of which the programs are, the level of the stage of maturity of the programs, is it because there's inadequacy in some of the resources, or whatever? Chair, I didn't pick up properly. From page 47, in any case, I've seen a couple of what I can see is overshadowed projects. Projects which seems have been going on but never got any prominence. And I just would like to get a little bit of an explanation on them. The first one is TRIP. I didn't get take the page, I'm sorry. T-H-R-I-P. And the Regional Industrial Development. The question there is whether it's linked to the erstwhile Regional Industrial Development Strategy, which disappeared at some stage, the Manufacturing Development Program, the NEPAD Implementation Strategy, APORDE in page 61. I'm sorry, I didn't take, I just took the acronym. Project Kulisum Noto. And lastly, Chair, the reference is made to page 102 about the delays in the Manufacturing Development Act. That's obviously a very interesting and exciting act. Probably some of us would have a keen interest on it in the context of advancing EPUB. One would like to know then why is there a delay on that? The Center for Entrepreneurship in page 66 makes reference to training for graduates only. Now, my quick response there is that is this facility for graduates only? How about non-graduates? I really thought, you know, a Center for Entrepreneurship would be open to all, including non-graduates. Thanks for now, Chair.
Yes, Honourable Njikalana, if you can bring up the rest of your questions, please, the ones that you will not have time for verbally asking. But let's, Honourable Turok.
Yeah. Thanks, Chair. I'm sorry I missed the Minister's opening address, but perhaps he covered some of the things I'm going to talk about, so forgive me. Firstly, on a technical question, on page 138, there's some stuff about terminations. It looks like there have been a lot of terminations at senior level, and I wonder if you could say something about that. Secondly, 54% of the budget is on incentives. I wonder if you could, I think we've had this before, but I wonder if you could give us a sort of breakdown. I've been looking for incentives in the document, and I can't actually find it. So since incentives is such a big proportion of the budget and so important, if you could at some stage give us a breakdown of where the incentives go to. You know, do they go to traditional business, new business, etc.? It's a rather important issue for this committee on a policy basis. So maybe at some other time, if it's not in one place in the book. Then a couple of more general points quickly is that we've been having some hearings here on gambling. And it's pretty tiresome because all sorts of characters come here and advocate increased gambling, basically. You know, they use different language. And I wonder whether the department, maybe together with the committee, but certainly the department, issues some broad statement. What is the government's view on gambling? Because these people come here and say gambling is enjoyment, it's fun, people want it, and all that kind of stuff, and yet we know that there are areas, as the minister knows very well from the days when he was sitting here, these payout machines and all that. I think it's time that we came out with a clear statement to the public and to the industry and say our position as government on gambling is X, Y, Z and finished and clear, and they mustn't come here and talk nonsense. Third point is I'm trying to understand the relationship of government with business. And we've often asked the Competition Commission how they actually operate in a hostile environment, but also in a non-antagonistic, to use Mao's phrase, a non-antagonistic environment. Could you give us a picture of how DTI relates to business? Do you relate to organized business? Do you relate to CIFSA, for example? Something on that to give us some idea of your interactions with business, organized, I mean, and obviously unorganized as well. Then the question of policy. I know the pressure you're under with personnel and all that, but I think there are so many big issues coming up on the table now. If you look at the president's speech in the opening speech of Parliament, so on and so on, and generally, the country is faced with quite serious policy decisions. And if DTI could produce documents, as you do on WTO and so on, I mean, the minister produces excellent statements and documents on the negotiations with ECA and Europe's Africa and so on. But there are other issues which are very policy important and in the public domain. And to the extent that you have time and energy, if the DTI could articulate policy on the bigger issues that are facing the country, this would be helpful from a DTI perspective. So, for instance, when Praveen Gordhan makes a speech as Minister of Finance and says various things about growth path and so on, it would be helpful if DTI could come out with a policy statement on that sort of material. And then finally, a comment on this report and the DG's presentation. You know, I think we're all aware of the fact that there's some serious issues at stake in the economy at the moment. And it's not just the recession. There's major structural deficiencies in the economy. We've inherited a very lopsided one. And it seems to me that I would like to see, if possible, that in addition to the adjustments and the improvements that the DG referred to, which go across a huge range of subjects, so one gets the impression that you're trying to maintain what you've got, improve here and there, but there isn't a refocusing. And my own view, and perhaps it's my own prejudice, is that the country must refocus on the inherited economy, what we're going to do about it, and not merely ameliorate and adjust. That's my view. I think that the general understanding in the country as a whole, and I think I'm not speaking for myself alone, that there is an understanding that there are serious, fundamental, structural problems in the economy. And I would like to see DTI say, we've identified the key elements and we're going to do so and so and so and so. Your report doesn't do that. It adds and it improves, and you keep saying we're doing more here, we're doing more there, and so on. I would like to say, hear you say, we're giving maximum prioritization to X, even at the cost of other programs. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Turok. Honourable Khadebe.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I think I'll concur with Honourable Fana Vestes in that we have to appreciate the work which is well done. That is, we're having an unqualified report. Also, we have to appreciate again the delegation which is in front of us. It is really non-racial and non-sexist, which is one of the imperatives of the Constitution. I think that one must also be appreciated. But what I want to go to is on page 189 of the annual report. I see that there's an indication on 16 there that there was non-compliance with Treasury Regulations 5.1, 5.2, and 6.1. The question why, what were the problems there in not complying with that? And then you go to page 210 of the annual report. I see that the unauthorized expenditure had decreased from $69 million in the 2007-08 financial year to $37 million in 2008-09, which is an improvement. But when coming to fruit less and wastes, it has actually increased from 11,000 to 86,000. What are the causes of that? And then we'll go to the other issue again, the issue of the impact of the agreements, interim agreements between Lesotho, Botswana, and the EU. What impact is it going to have in our economies? Because we have this free flow of goods between those countries. So are we not going to run a risk of having the goods which are coming from the subsidized European countries where the farmers are subsidized, and then eventually those goods getting through into South Africa? What measures did the department do to curb that problem? Thank you. I see the issue of industrial participation on page 14. I'm from the Free State. I see the Free State does not feature there. Is it because the Free State has not paid their tax, so that their money was not used there. What is the reason for that? Because it's one of the depressed provinces. Thank you.
They thought it was free. But look, on a more serious note, and thank you, one of the points made in the presentation and the areas covered, trade, investment, exports, etc., and also some of the statements made and so on, with respect to SACU, MACOSA, and really when one takes into account the EPAs, etc., and one understands the importance then of regional integration, all of that, and perhaps the threat or risk currently under that situation, I wondered just how, considering that we have a SACU as a body, and then you have what it is, the bilateral almost, some point with India, I think the reference was made. Now, it would be useful for me to have a clearer understanding as to, and even, of course, with MACOSA, exactly what is the relationship impact there between the two, considering the current challenges prevailing under SACU and the EPAs, that situation. And just one other thing here, I've always been interested in the polymers myself, and just reminding some of the researchers, this had to do with petroleum and that kind of thing. Of course, they got the full composition for me. I see we are actually, you know, actually providing certain incentives and financial supports in this area, and I'm all for increasing our technical skills here, but I would appreciate an explanation as to the beneficiation here. We would, I'm sure, still continue to import quite a lot of the raw materials, as I see it, petroleum, if my understanding is still correct. And then, indeed, we do add to it very, very seriously and provide jobs. Perhaps we can get a little bit of an understanding, apart from simply the skills and the training and the jobs, how else does that benefit us until we ourselves find an increased supply of petroleum within our country and alongside our shores. The final point is to do with the performance. Point has already been made about the audits and that kind of thing, but it was interesting to see that the majority had been completed the contract, 90%, 96 or something, but there does seem to be a few just still outstanding, and one would have liked to have known just when is the deadline for the completion of these contracts, performance contracts themselves. And thank you once again, Minister. I know you've got a full bank here, but it'll be up to you to you and the team to tackle this.
Well, thanks, thanks, Chair. I'm going to try a bit of a division of labour, and I'm just going to ask my colleagues to just take note. I'm going to make a comment on the four points that Mr. Maria raised, and I'll make a comment on the restructuring of agencies that Mr. Njikalana made. I will make a comment on the four last points that Professor Turok made. I will build in the point about the EPAs in the answer to Mr. Murray, that the additional point that was made by Mr. Khadebi, and I will also build in the into the point you made about the EPAs, and I'll ask my colleagues if they can take the rest. Maybe some of the team will also want to add to the to what I say. But I would just want to say, just I want to comment on two other things extraordinarily briefly. Just to say on the questions raised by the about the Auditor General's report, I think first of all, thanks for the comments. I let the team answer in more detail. But just to say that I think that the points of emphasis that were made in the Auditor General's report are all about compliance matters of a technical nature. It's not about anybody's got their hand in the till. Now, clearly what we need to do is we need to respond to those positively and aim for an audit report in which there is no point of emphasis at all. I think that's what we need to do, but I think we should just understand that that is essentially the gist of it. And when I met with the Auditor General's team, with the Director General, that is basically what they agreed as well. It's not matters of serious kind of malfeasance at all. Secondly, I just want to say very briefly on the disability target. Yes, it's low, but I think that I just wanted to say this Soweto facility, core facility, I think is a very important learning curve for the department. What we've got there is this major call center. Actually, it's supposed to deal with the most important foreign direct investment inquiries, the biggest ones, actually. And what happened was that we decided we needed to address that question of upping our percentage. And then we went and we actually understood we don't really need to be trying to deal with people with disability, but we need to be recognizing the ability of those people. And many of them have actually got experience and skills and so on, and actually a lot better placed. They may be sitting in wheelchairs, but they're better placed in terms of all the characteristics we require to run a call center. The other thing about a call center is that call center has very high turnover of staff. These people will not be moving very quickly. We've located it in the Cheshire Home in Soweto because they're members of the DTI staff, but bringing them to the DTI was less effective than leaving them in their environment where they've got the support. So I think we've learned something quite important about that, and I think that's something that we can take further forward. Let me move to Mr. Maria's points. I don't believe that the picture is one of there is a particular higher value-added component of our trade with the developed countries than there is with China, Brazil, India. I don't think that is the picture. The picture is rather that our existing trade with China, India, and Brazil is, at the moment, too dominated by exports of primary products and not sufficiently by value-added products. That is the reality. Our biggest exports of value-added products actually go to the African continent and the Southern African region in particular. You look at our export basket there, it's a different story. That is our existing picture. Now, I think it's what is quite right is that we don't want to reproduce that pattern in an expanding relationship with these dynamic economies of the South. And the whole point of our engagement with these countries and our prioritization of negotiations with these countries is to try to change the mix in favor of higher value-added products. Now, with China, according to our figures, we have an absolute trade deficit with China. They don't see it that way, and it's all to do with gold that is exported to them through Hong Kong. But where they do agree with us is that we have, and we use this phrase in our discussions with them, a structural deficit. And the structural deficit is we export primary products predominantly, and we import manufacturers from them. And they've accepted that they need to work with us to change that pattern. Now, that is a discourse. We have not yet followed this through sufficiently with China, although we will be prioritizing some high-level engagements with China. We have been engaging on this matter at all sorts of levels quite energetically, but we will be taking that further forward. We're not yet at the point where we have absolute proposals in place, but we have something called a Partnership for Growth and Development with China. And it's our ambition to insert into that a whole lot of measures that would address that particular problem, particularly looking at matters like their procurement systems in China. How do they work? Can we be included in that for our value-added goods? Those sorts of things. With Brazil yesterday, I had a meeting with Minister Miguel Jorge, who is my counterpart from Brazil, and we were talking about the same issue and about identifying industrial sector complementarities so that we're not trying to say we must move in to your market and smash your domestic capacity. You must move into our market and smash our domestic capacity. But are there not areas where we are complementary and where we can actually expand trade, cooperation, and investment? And I think we're beginning to start that dialogue. I was very happy with the outcome of that meeting yesterday with Minister George. I think we're pushing that forward. And we're saying the same thing to India as well. So I think that's what we're trying to seek. We're not trying to seek a reproduction and enlargement of the existing relationship. We're actually trying to seek a change in the pattern. And because they are developing countries, because they know what it takes to promote industrial development, I think we are getting a common understanding at least, and we need to translate that into new arrangements. That doesn't mean that we're neglecting the countries of the North, because we're not. We need to continue to trade with those countries. we need to, there are sources of investment and so on and so forth. But I mean, the pattern of trade there is not, is fundamentally the same. Our export basket to those countries is dominated by primary products. As far as the MIDP is concerned and the Automotive Production Development Program, I think Nimrod's out for one to add to this, but let me just say that I think that the reality is that any developing country that is industrializing has got an auto sector. Let the auto sector go, and you're going to be deindustrializing. I think that is basically the picture. Now, the auto sector, what we want to emphasize and what we want to support is actually component manufacturing, which is more job intensive. We want to emphasize buses, yellow fleet, heavy vehicles, things like that, construction equipment. We want to move in those new directions, but we've got to do this on the basis of a platform of OEM manufacturing. We also want to try to push the OEMs to manufacture more the percentage of the production of the motor vehicle. We want to increase the percentage that is actually manufactured in South Africa as well. And the reality is that unless you have an OEM base in your country, you don't have a component industry as well. And we're constantly having to strike a balance between, for example, the duty credit facilities we offer. I mean, clearly for the OEMs themselves, they'd like it to be more, so they get more stuff imported. But if you do that, then the auto components industry would suffer. We have to strike a balance, and the component manufacturers strike that balance as well, in function of recognizing the importance of OEM manufacturing in the country. I mean, every country in the world, even in the United States, in the southern states of the United States and things, they have a very extensive program of incentives. Ours is modest compared to Mercosur. Look at the tariff protection that we offer compared to Mercosur, about 10% less. And there are all kinds of reasons why the industry doesn't want to change it. There's also the value of the incentives. Ours is a relatively modest program. We're not in the high league in terms of offering incentives on a massive scale. So I think that actually when we look at that balance, what is the benefits and what are the costs? That's the issue. I'll ask Nimrod to see if he can give any figures. But I think when we look at that balance, what we have to do is we have to look at the impact on other industrial sectors, the impact on jobs, not only in the automotive sector itself, but on the other industrial sectors that are linked to it, and the consequences and costs of letting the automotive sector go. I think there would be enormous damage to the industrial economy if we did that. And so what we're doing in the very difficult circumstances is we are trying to make sure that we make that the investments by the OEMs, and we want to encourage, obviously, investments not in the kind of motor vehicles that are going to be on the margins because there's a shift towards more energy efficient motor vehicles, but we want to ensure that we have new generation products coming in manufactured in South Africa. I mean, we have had, I think, the BMW decision was an important statement of confidence, and I think we're working energetically on a couple of others which I don't want to announce right now, but there are a couple of others which we're working on as well. As far as the textiles and aluminium extrusion, I think they're slightly different problems, but the clothing and textiles, the clothing industry has clearly been affected by import penetration, and we know where the imports have been coming from. But I think there's a number of dimensions to that import penetration. One of them is illegal imports, under-invoicing, goods that are false labels and stuff like that, a huge illegal competition. When we look at the industry and talk to the industry, they tell us that actually if there's fair competition, abiding by the rules, they are convinced that they can make some headway in this country. There are real possibilities for clothing manufacturers, actually not just to save jobs, but actually to grow jobs. The consultancy study around the new incentive is telling us if we get it right, we can actually grow jobs in the clothing industry. Where? Fast fashion. It takes at least a month for some new line of clothing to come from abroad. Fast fashion, ability to respond quickly to changes in demands from manufacturers, from retailers. This is something which industries based here have a huge advantage over, and some of the better clothing firms are doing just that. Sportswear, tents, camping equipment, that kind of stuff, specialized textiles. We have an advantage there, which I think we're making headway on. And then all kinds of new textile products and all kinds of new innovations that are possible. What we're doing, the new incentive, which is in the process, maybe Nimran could tell us where it is actually. I thought it might have come back by now, but we put it out for consultation with the bargaining council of the industry. The biggest problem we have in that industry is that people are not investing. The manufacturers are not investing. We have a phenomenon called sweating the assets, that you run the damn machines until they break down, you retrieve everything, then you walk away from the industry. That's what we've got, too much in the industry. And the problem is that the duty credit certificate, as it's worked now, the very small number of people that export, they then sell them to the retailers, and they damage the people who are not exporting by importing more components and more products. So what we're saying is we need to move away from that into a model which is actually similar to the APDP. Instead of exports, it'll be value-added. What value-added are you producing? You will earn a credit. That credit will be banked in the IDC. This is the proposal. And then when you've reached enough of that credit, you will be able to use that not to buy a house in Plettenberg Bay, but to invest in the industry. Invest in the industry. And we think that will address the big thing that everyone's saying, the need to raise the productivity and the competitiveness of the industry. That's the proposal which we're putting forward. Subsidized competition. Well, you know, there is a remedy. It's called countervailing duties, which is, you say, you work out what the subsidies, you apply countervailing duty. I think there are a couple of reasons why that would be. It's not excluded in principle when there would be something which could be applied to ITAC 4. But I think it just is a generality just to say that, well, we would have a huge problem in applying countervailing duties. It would damage our relations with key target countries. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that actually we don't necessarily want to go around the world and reduce people's policy space to support industries. So I think what we want to do in terms of the trade remedies is we've upped the tariff to the bound rate. We've upped the tariff. We're having a massive crackdown, which is going on now, and which we intend to expand and intensify on illegal imports. And I think that will be our attempt to try to create the level playing field and then to support the industry. And I think if we do something like that, this is what the research is telling us, we could actually grow jobs in that industry. Let me now talk to the question of the economic partnership agreement, signatures, and so on. This is, as you all know, a very long-running saga. The difficulty that we had as South Africa with the interim economic partnership agreements was not actually with the trading goods schedule. The negotiation on that was actually never hit, and it never concluded. The problems we had were with a whole lot of trade-related obligations. And I think these we see as something to do with the competition which the European Union is facing on the African continent with other important players that are emerging as important trading and investment forces on the African continent. And so they sought to insert a whole lot of clauses which would have curtailed policy space. They wanted prohibitions on export taxes. This more favored nation clause, which we have not yet resolved, is a very important issue. What they were trying to say is that every country that signs the EPA must commit to, if you negotiate with a third party that's got more than 1% of world trade, that's India, Brazil, China, and you give them on a line-by-line basis anything better than you give to the European Union, you must give the same to the European Union. That's what they said. And they said this is fair because actually what's happening is they're giving duty-free, quota-free access, which is the best they could possibly offer. Now, for South Africa, they wouldn't, even if we signed an EFA, they wouldn't give us duty-free, quota-free. They said, no, you're too competitive. We will give you some improvement over the Trade Development Cooperation Agreement. We never finalized that. And they said, because of that, South Africa would not be expected to implement that on a line by line basis, but South Africa would be expected to consult with them if such a circumstance arose. Now, I've been saying to everybody in Europe that will listen, we have a customs union in SACU. We are all bound by the same arrangement. We can't talk to the European Union as Germany versus France. And what they are saying is they're saying that Swaziland, let me say, for an example, would be forced to apply that, and we would only have to consult. But yet we're in the same customs union. Where would this arise in practice? This would arise in practice in some agricultural product that's subsidized of minor, minuscule commercial importance to the European Union. Yet if they forced this differential arrangement in SACU, they would undermine the coherence of SACU. And I said, yet you say that the EPA is supposed to support regional integration. In reality, where does regional integration stand in the hierarchy of your interests? It seems to us below some minuscule commercial disadvantage they might face by not forcing this thing on Swaziland. I've never heard anybody in the EU say that's wrong or why it has to be like that. But that's the issue, that's the biggest issue that remains outstanding in the EPA negotiations. We are going into another round of discussions with them. We will see where this goes. Namibia is in a very invidious position because South Africa, we've got the Trade Development Cooperation Agreement. Angola, the countries in SADC that have not signed, Angola has got access as a least developed country. The Minister Geingob says, how the hell is Angola a least developed country and Namibia not? So I think he's got a point. But they're not. They're not classified that way. So hypothetically, Namibia could have the benefits withdrawn. The commissioner said she won't do it, but a member state might. We've indicated to South Africa we'd regard that as an extremely unfriendly and anti-developmental act if they were to remove access for Namibia. That's more or less the state of play where we find ourselves in. We have not said, as a country, that we want to walk into SACU and punish those that have signed the agreement. We've never said anything like that. We've said that we understand the pressures on those that felt themselves obliged to sign. We also think there should be an understanding for those like Namibia who don't want to sign. What we have said is we have warned objectively the pressures of the EPA are threatening some of the coherence in SACU. I've mentioned it in the MFN context. The other one about the border issue, it was not that we would get products coming in with tariff issues that they would be flooding the market, because the EU said what they would do is they would, as they put it, retrofit the entry into SACU with the Trade Development Cooperation Agreement. As far as tariffs are concerned, there would be no change in the tariff in the terms of entry into SACU from the current arrangement. But we pointed out there was a difference in the rules of origin. And the rules of origin, the main thing is it comes in the question of clothing and textile products. Under the TDCA, you have to have two stages of transformation. You have to have more value addition before the thing qualifies. Under the EPA, one stage. You can sew a button on the shirt and send it in. And we simply raised the point that the matter of coherence between the rules of origin under the TDCA and under the EPA has to be addressed. So I think that was the issue that we were raising. And we said that, look, this matter has to be addressed. Otherwise, you're going to oblige us to try to limit entry through the other countries. That will again undermine the coherence of SACU. We went into SACU and we said to SACU, this is to take the SACU debate a step further forward. We went into a ministerial which was more or less a retreat a few months ago, and we said to them, look, this is our vision of SACU. We said the problem with SACU is, although it's the world's oldest customs union, which will celebrate its centenary next year, for most of that time, it has been a relationship of convenience forged around a revenue sharing formula. It has not been a tool of regional integration. So it's held together because South Africa got access into their markets. I think it's less important now. And in return for that, paid a disproportionate part of the revenue pool to those countries. That's what held it together. And we're saying it cannot any longer stay there with the trends that are happening in regional integration and with the pressures which have been put on us by, among other things, the EPA. And what we're saying is it's noticeable that this year the world's oldest customs union, older than the EU, but hasn't got a single cross-border project, not a single one. There's no funded money which says we're going to support a corridor program through SACU. Not a single project like that. So how can this be? How can this be? Because we can actually turn this thing into a tool of integration. We can move it further towards, in fact, further towards an economic union and advance the level of integration. We said if we're going to do that, we're going to have at least an understanding of three things. One, some idea about the importance and priority of industrial development in Tariff City. We can't have a situation where some of us regard tariff setting as a tool of industrial development. Some others think it's just to raise revenue or it's you can hold it hostage for something else or something. That's the first thing. The second thing, we have to have some common understanding about trade negotiations. What are we prepared to agree to in terms of obligations? We can't have a situation where we all think some think that this is okay, others think it's not. We can't have that. We have to have a common position. And the third one is we have to have an agreement about direction of trade. We can't have a situation where, for us, negotiations with Brazil, India, China is a priority and somebody else doesn't think it's the case. If we can reach a common understanding on those, we think we can advance this thing towards an economic union. If not, we want to resign or anything, but we think the pressures on this thing will actually undermine it. That's the point. That's the point that we made. Everybody said they want to go for the first project. Well, we'll have to wait and see. We'll see how it unfolds as we move along. But we are committed to an approach which actually advances regional integration and advances the use of SACU as an instrument of that. Let me move on to the agencies and the restructuring and the COTI question. Well, I'm not in a position to announce anything today, but there is a process underway in which there will be a responsibility for some of the agencies transferred to economic development. That will happen. That has been something which has been on the table since the new government came in. But what we are working towards is not a situation where something is taken out of one silo and put into another silo, but actually where we break down the silo approach. So actually, although that will happen, we have agreed with EDD we will continue to have COTI. All the agencies will be part of COTI, and we will work together in COTI, that we will have what has been called walk-in rights, that there will be no change in the functional relationship between any of the agencies which may fall under EDD and under us. We want to try to break away from silos and into a much more coordinated approach. I think what I did say to come on to one of the questions of Professor Turok about policy documents, I did indicate that the next industrial policy action plan is pretty close to finalization. And the last kind of things that are awaiting on this are a few decisions to just fill in some details on particular sectors and things of that sort. But one of the things that we have said very, very clearly in that is that our ability to conduct industrial policy on a higher impact scale, because everything you heard in the report was the first crack at industrial policy, which we said was choosing the easy to do things, and now we want a higher impact. We are going to produce something between that and where we think we need to end up. The next one, it's not going to, but it's a higher impact. But it is absolutely critically dependent on our ability to produce coordination across government and coordination of macro and micro policy. Absolutely critically dependent on that. Just to enter one of the debates, very briefly, I don't mind entering this debate. Everybody, including the Harvard group, said that unless we have a competitive exchange rate, we are not going to, everything else we do in industrial policy is going to be undermined. That's what they said. We cannot have a situation where we just ignore that factor and we just talk about other things. We have got to have a coordination around macro and micro policy and then within the different divisions of micro policy. So we're going to have to crack away from the silos in a very significant and dramatic way. So just to conclude then, I'm not at all fazed by the fact that some of the agencies will now report to the EDD, because I don't think that this is going to be another set of silos. On the, just to conclude that point of Professor Turok's, I also said before you came in that the trade policy document is pretty close to coming out in the public domain. The document's finished. It's almost through the processes. And then I said that the other one that we're working on, the piece of work, is the review of the impact of SME programs and co-op programs. SME and co-op programs. So I said those things are there. Which is to get on to the last point you made, although I'll address two more. The last point you made was the question of structural deficiencies. I mean, absolutely. I mean, I just make a very simple point. I made this in a lot of inputs I've made in all kinds of occasions. But the fact of the matter is that before the crisis, we had the longest period of uninterrupted growth, at least since the Second World War, probably since statistics were kept. The growth rate reached over 5%, and yet unemployment never got less than 21% on the strict definition. So, what does this say? This says that actually simply a simple expanded reproduction of what we've got is not going to crack it. If we push the growth rate to 6-7%, it's still not going to crack it. We have to make structural changes. I mean, we confront a problem of structural unemployment. My understanding of the economic history of this country, that structural unemployment started to come on track in the middle of the 1970s and was one of the causes of the crisis of the apartheid system. It came on track when the mining industry stopped trying to recruit large numbers of unskilled pick and shovel people. The mining industry passed its prime. Those people started to become marginalized, sent to the Bantustans originally. When apartheid influx control collapsed, those people started coming to the towns. Those people don't have skills. Those people are unemployed. That is the structural problem. And it's not going to change. We're not going to change that picture unless we change the trajectory of the economy. And that is why in every single sector that we emphasize, you will see we will be targeting the more labor-absorbing parts of it. And indeed, the manufacturing part of it is only going to be an important catalyst of a whole lot of other service activities and so on. We've got to start to make changes in the structural configuration of the economy if we're going to address those kinds of problems. The government-business relationship, I think there's a number of dimensions of that. In a lot of activities, we do relate with organized business. I mean, trade missions, conferences of one sort or another, and so on. We relate with organized business. And I think that, one of the things is, and maybe at some point you might want to reflect on this, is organized business is countries facing huge challenges. And compared to organized business in other countries, very small organizations, limited ability to service all the kinds of international arrangements and cooperations, which are critically important. Limited ability to do that. I think there's some massive challenges with organized business. I mean, our approach is we try to assist them in organizing trade missions. We try to assist them with a lot of the work that we can do in that regard, but I think that is a challenge. We relate with organized business, but also organized labor in NEDLAC. We also relate with organized business and organized labor in sectoral work, both within the framework of the crisis and also in the Industrial Policy Action Plan. I mean, this thing which is called self-discovery is a product of that. Different sectors are differently organized. I think some sectors are not beyond lobbying, and other sectors are actually sources of quite significant wisdom. I mean, we try to build on it. We also interact with industrialists in a sort of informal way, where we look at things like how does the manufacturing industry look like and what are the kind of macroeconomic challenges and so on and so forth. I mean, when I say that I know the exchange rate is not competitive, it's not because I'm E. Rob Davies thinks so. It's because every time I meet with somebody who's in the manufacturer, they tell us so. So that's why I know that, why we say that. Then lastly, Professor Turok's blog, on gambling. I think you are quite right that we need to produce a policy statement. What we have got is we've got an impact process, assessment process, which is going on. We want to look at that report and discuss that report and have it discussed with you in the portfolio committee as well. And I have actually said myself, I'm not prepared to to sign on to any new gambling activity until I've seen what that says. You know, I think that some of the earlier research that was done by the National Gambling Board, for example, a 2003 study did show that the gross gambling product of South Africa was enormously high. There was a ranking of countries, I can't quite remember the number, I think we were 11th, and we were way above a number of countries which are much higher GDP per capita. And then they also looked at different income categories, and you found, well, not a big surprise, but where the form of activity was accessible, like the lottery. Many people, even on very low income categories, lowest income categories, were playing those games. So,
the report of last week had a much more...
Honourable Turok, well, we must go on mic if you got
it. No, we need to interrogate all of that, and then on the basis of that, take decisions. I think that's basically where we need to go on that. And then lastly, just on the chair's point about the, I think I've done the EPAS and regional integration, but the bilateral, as you said, with India. Well, actually, it's not strictly a bilateral. What happens is that since the 2001 SACA agreement has come into force, on any trade negotiation, which is a tariff negotiation, we are supposed to operate in SACA. So when we negotiate a preferential trade agreement, as you saw there with Mercosur, it was a SACA Mercosur. And it's the same with India. So there's a process going on now of negotiation at the SACA level. But, of course, on a whole range of cooperation arrangements, through IBSA, for example, we have extensive cooperation with the small business entities in India as well as Brazil, with their equivalents of the IDCs and so on. I'll leave the question of the DFIs to somebody else, but, I mean, there's a very extensive interaction which we have in with the BNDES in Brazil. And just to say that the BNDES in Brazil is able to increase its impact on the economy because it has a regular injection of funds into its balance sheet. The IDC, well, we're operating on the balance sheet that was left to the IDC by Jan Smuts. I mean, they've invested in all sorts of things and they gear the balance sheet, but the balance sheet itself has not actually been added to by any regular injection of funding. The BNDES, on the other hand, is able to expand its role by such an arrangement. But I'll leave that discussion you'll see there will be proposals on that which we'll put forward when we come to the next IPAC, but I'll leave that further discussion to somebody else. That's all from me, but I can ask the DG to nominate the rest of the team who he wants to answer the other questions.
Now let's just hear the responses without too much interjection, but people are welcome to, but let's go on mic.
No, I guess the questions are self-selecting. I mean, there are questions that Sarah should deal with around things like HR plan not in place, record keeping, leave. There are questions that I'm sure Nimrod would want to come in on some of the industrial policy issues. Dumelo on the incentives. Sipo on the industrial participation, the geographic spread stuff. Kumaran on fruitless expenditure. That seems to be those issues, and I'll come in on the agencies. I mean, just supplement some of the comments that the minister made on the agencies. Sipho, I think you must also deal with this project Tourism North, which is our attempt to enter the regional economic development space, local economic development space, and some of the ideas we have going forward in regard to that. Okay.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, DG Minister. I'll start off
just to build on the question around our empowerment of people with disabilities, the DG in the presentation touched on the investment call center, and the minister also talked about that, the investment call center that has been capacitated with people with disabilities. When we reported in 2008 and 9, we were standing at 1%. As we speak now, we are standing at 2%. So we have actually achieved the target. And it was not just about the investment call center giving us that boost, but also internally, we have made some appointments where we've seen that we actually have representation even at senior management level. So from 11 employees, we've now moved to 23 employees, basically making us to achieve that target of 2%. The issue of leave management has been really a very sore point for us. And just to put it in context, what you have in the public service basically is that you have PERSAL, which is the HR management system, but it doesn't help you to automate some of the processes. So we still have leave being dealt with on a manual basis. So this transversal system is not really helping in terms of having an automated process to manage leave. So what we did in the department was that we came up with a system that could assist us to automate the process so that, you know, there are controls around that. What we found out is that the system was really not, was never, because obviously there were some challenges around that system and it was delayed, so the capturing of leave. So all the queries that you are picking up in the audit report are basically because of the system that it thought that it would really resolve most of our problems around control, but it was actually creating more problems. So we've discontinued that system. We've gone back to the drawing board to say, let's relook at that so that we can deal with the issue, so that we can come up with a system that would really help us to take that forward. So we are back at the manual system, and there's a turnaround already. We hope that by the end of this financial year, 2009 and 10, would be in a better position and would have dealt with most of the queries. The HR plan, like the minister has indicated, they talked about it, more compliance. You'd know that it was for the first time that as a department we now had an HR plan in 2008 and 9. So the audited the HR plan that we had. Obviously, it was submitted, I think, after the deadline of September, which is the deadline given to us by public service and administration. So we did submit, but we've actually gone beyond that. We've now looked at the issues that have been raised in the 2008 and 9 HR plan. We've compiled the 2009 and 10 HR plan. We've dealt with the compliance issues that had been raised there. And the revised report is already en route for approval by the minister. What we are also looking at is that we would want to ensure that planning, HR planning, is aligned to the normal planning, you know, the bigger planning of the department. And in due course, you know, going from 10, 11, going forward, we hope that we would be able to plan. As we plan for other, you know, departmental objectives and so forth, or planning for resources, would also be planning for human resource issues. The issue around record keeping. Again, just putting the context there, we do have a centralized record management area or function. And the challenges that we faced, well, that we picked up there when we reviewed the business process, say, why are we not in a position to be able to provide a documentation well on time? We found that the number of staff that we had to retrieve, because we have voluminous documents, understanding that we're trying to ensure that we maximize how we utilize our accommodation, but apart from that, to ensure that we also promote proper record keeping and so forth. So we have a centralized record management function, but the number of staff that we had in that area were obviously not inadequate to respond to the challenge. We've looked at that. What we've also done is that we are now scanning documentation so that it becomes available electronically, and I think that would do away with some of the challenges. Also, the issue of when people draw documents, I think that was also a problem, because some of the documents we did find that would have given to the auditors, and
and they didn't submit them back. So those are some of the things. So we tightened controls in terms of logging where hard copies are retrieved. But I think the scanning solution is the one that will help us to deal with some of the challenges. Terminations, particularly around the senior management levels. The profile of the department, if you look at the makeup in terms of the various categories, most of the concentration of our staff is around level your senior management and a level below because of the nature of work that we do. So those two categories, your middle management and your SMS, constitute over 57%. So the challenge, obviously, you would see when you have those terminations is around that area. But what we've done is that we have finalized a process where we actually did a dipstick because we are trying to understand why people are leaving. We've done a quick dipstick through a survey where we are looking at issues of people management, issues of, you know, work-life balance, whether people are being given an opportunity to engage and be innovative. So we've completed a draft retention strategy that we will be presenting to our operations committee in the coming week. That actually looks at those issues to say, how do we ensure that people do not leave the department? You would also note, if you were to do a comparative analysis, that actually our turnover has gone down from 14% to 11%, percent, which is it's really comparable with the going rates in the marketplace. So, but we believe that we can actually do better than that. Even the vacancy rate, also it's another indicator showing that from 25 to 18, we are now at 17.9%. Even having had to create new positions, over 100 positions in this financial year, but we've managed to even bring that figure from 18.1 to 17.9. So the retention strategy, and we hope that in a month or two it will be approved, it will help us to really deal with that. Our approach to it is that we are also providing a toolkit because, as you would know, retention is about management. So we are trying to provide managers with a toolkit to say, how do we deal with these issues? Because it's not something that HR can deal with, you know, alone. I think I've covered most of the issues. Did you think?
Alex, deal with the performance contract. I think the chair asked the performance contracts. Could you pick that question up on the performance? But the question was, we're not 100%. We're in the 90s, in the late 90s, but we're not in 100%. You know. What are the issues there?
Okay. The performance contract a challenge there. Some of the, what you would find, Chair, is that you would find people who've come on board during the process. If, for instance, SMS are allowed to have a window period of 3 months before they can contract. And here and there you'll have maybe one or two individuals where there are disputes. But if you look at the overall picture, it's not something that is really a problem in the department. Again, looking at comparative analysis, I think we're doing very well. We have a handle on this. So those issues would be people terminating or people coming on board and so forth.
Thanks, Chair. I'll respond on the issues and some of the issues from the Enterprise and Empowerment Division. The NIPP, the JOS spread, we will be getting an opportunity early next year to come and do an annual update on the program. The last one we did was in February this year, so we hope the committee will give us an opportunity to come back next year. Just to give a clear bit. But a brief comment on the spread. Unfortunately, this doesn't show the real picture, I mean the drawing there, the real picture in terms of the spread of projects. This just shows the projects that are active now. With the program, because it started in 99, I'm talking about the arms bill offsets, you'll find that some projects were done and concluded, and the companies were given credits for the work they have done there, and they are no longer claiming anything. So those projects won't be appearing here. But we decided yesterday that in the next presentation, we'll bring the fuller picture. Like in the Free State, there is a gold beneficiation project, that Harmony Gold, where we invested money, the offset invested money for the beneficiation of the bullion into what is called the investment bars. They also, the very same company, the British Aerospace System, GlassSAP, also invested in the gold chain projects. But unfortunately, that project has terminated, but it employed about 500 women, rural women, and it was exporting gold that were manufactured by hand. So, but in the next presentation, we'll give it a fuller picture. A comment on the low level of SMME assistance appearing in the report from honorable members. I think, you know, we will always face budget problems. The CEDA institution that provides the non-financial support, it's rolling out infrastructure throughout the provinces, but there isn't much, you know, budget support in terms of hiring staff, hiring consultants to do the work in the provinces. When you talk about the DFIs, again, they will still face a huge budget constraints in terms of matching the business plans, you know, and the amount of money we get from the allocations. The Kulusum Noto project, like Minister was saying, this afternoon will be discussing as a department on the new vision of the Enterprise and Empowerment Division, which also incorporates the regional economic development and the risk strategy. We're working on that. So far, we have managed to do the regional economic clustering on 17 district municipalities, and we want to cover all the municipalities in South Africa. So the Kulusum Noto thing started as just a capacity building in the local economic development sphere, but it's ballooning out now. We will be doing the regional economic clustering and then taking our institutions into those areas and say, what support can we give to the potential entrepreneurs according to the opportunities that will be identified by the research that we are doing. And the Center for Entrepreneurship, really, it's not for just students. It's open to entrepreneurs who want to get any kind of assistance from the universities, like University of Witwatersrand and University of Johannesburg, that are part of this scheme. We've just launched the one at the University of Johannesburg, at the University of Witwatersrand. The University of Johannesburg, they are already advanced in terms of assisting entrepreneurs, more especially those that come from the township. They also have a branch in Soweto where people come from time to time and get assistance. So we will be spreading this model throughout the other universities in the country. Yeah, I think that covers the EEDDs. Thanks.
Thanks, Chair. I think the question that was asked was about by Prof. Turok, it's about the our incentives, given the fact that they are the largest part of the budget. I think the thing to note about the incentives is actually that A large part of the DTI incentives are off budget. Minister in his response spoke quite a lot about the Automotive Development Program, or the MIDT. It is one of the largest incentives that we have, and it's actually off budget. It's not reflected on the DTI budget, and that's simply because it is offered through duty rebates, and as such, it's not a cash grant. But then we do have a number of on-budget incentives. That, together with the IDZ, that it amount to close to about 3 billion. The largest program that we have in terms of the incentives that are on budget is the Small Medium Enterprise Development Program, which has now been revised and is the Enterprise Investment Program. And it was revised last year, and the changes that were made were changes that were made following the launch of the NIPF and the IPAP. And some of the changes that we made to the SMEDP in the new program now, which is the MIP, was firstly to bring into the program some of the principles that are encapsulated in the National Industrial Policy Framework. And those are some of the issues, things that we brought in was to, one, try and closely align with the sectors that policy is targeting. And so in terms of the new scheme, there is a priority that is given to sectors such as capital goods, such as chemicals, such as transport equipment, and so forth. So companies that are now receiving cash grants would be companies that are closely aligned to that. And then also the incentives then prioritizes after that. It prioritizes those companies that create quite a lot of jobs. So when we do assess projects that come to us looking for support, we would look at first the priority sector. We would look at the job intensity of the projects that come. And also we would look, if neither of those two are there, we would try and get a balance between job intensity and BEE, if at all a company is not in the priority sector. But also the program was amended to say that in the tourism sector, our focus, the reason we are focusing on that sector is because of job creation. So whereas in the past we focused quite a lot on lifestyle businesses, such as B&Bs that did not create quite a lot of jobs, we've now set a minimum job criteria for the tourism program. In order to be able to access the tourism program, a company needs to be creating a minimum of 8 jobs. We've made some relaxations for very small, because we also want to promote entry of BEs into the sector, so we have made some relaxation for small black-owned businesses on the tourism program. So the EIP is the largest program, or it's potentially the largest program that is on the budget. And as claims on the SMEDP come down, because we normally approve new projects and we approve projects that are expanding. That is, people who are adding new productive capacity. And normally, companies that we've approved, they would stay with us for 3 years after having invested in a new program, in new capital equipment, or in new productive capacity. And so we would have obligations to them for the next 3 years. They would stay on our budget. So what we expect to happen over the next 3 years is that the amount of grants that we are paying to companies under the SMEDP would come down, and under the EIP, you would see that part of the budget growing. And the second largest, or the other two biggest programs, would be then sector-focused programs, and one would be the business process outsourcing, which is a program that was started about 3 years ago, and that was focused more on creating jobs and creating jobs by focusing on attracting work from developed countries, especially business process outsourcing to South Africa. When the program was launched, the idea was to attract close to 25,000, to create 25,000 direct jobs in South Africa and an additional induced jobs of about 75,000 to 100,000 jobs. And the incentives was offered to try and attract, you know, to try and get first movers, the big multinationals who are dominating the space. And in that sense, it has been quite successful in the sense that we've been able to attract quite a number of the large BPO companies into South Africa, one being Teletech, another one being Teleperformance, and also a number of Indian companies that have invested in South Africa and are offering services to offshore markets from South Africa. Another big program in terms of the budget would then be the film program, which I think the DG covered in his presentation, that has now been, which previously tried to, was also trying to, was in the space of exporting services and developing the film sector in South Africa by attracting foreign productions into South Africa. That was amended also last year to focus not only on attracting foreign productions, but also making sure that we develop the local film sector. Then, in addition to that, we have a number of programs, one on co-ops and one Black Business Supplier Development Program that are focusing on the second economy. And I think the same principles flow through in the sense that most of the activities that we would then and most of the projects that we would fund would be new projects, and it would be projects that bring in additionality where yeah. I think maybe I will stop here.
Thanks, Chair. Let me start off with the MIDP. I think the Minister has answered a number of the aspects of the question, but I think the one area that I want to address is this issue of net economic benefit. And we do actually have some figures on this because we're in the process of responding to a parliamentary question. By the honourable member. Yes. when we were preparing the program that will replace the MIDP, the APDP, one of the things that we did look at is what are the net economic costs and benefits of the program. So we asked the Industrial Development Corporation's modeling section to do some economic modeling for us and to model some scenarios. So they modeled various scenarios for us, but I think the two relevant ones here are if one looks forward over the period 2008 to 2020, what position would we be in the economy if we had to compare a scenario where there was no support, you know, where support to the automotive sector ended abruptly at the end of 2012, what would the situation be under the APDP, the new program? And some of the key things that came out of this exercise is that if one takes both the direct contribution of the auto sector and adds the linkage and multiplier effects, so the flow through right through to the rest of the economy, the GDP in 2020 would be 103.3 billion rand higher than it otherwise would have been compared to, from the period 2008 to 2020. Investment would be 151.7 billion rand higher. Employment would be 320,000 more jobs than one would otherwise than one would have had with no auto program. The trade deficit would be substantially improved by about 833.3 million rand per annum. And there's a modest net positive net revenue of about 20 billion rand. So those we think are the key metrics if one compares the scenario of no support to the automotive sector compared to the scenario of the APDP. And obviously, I mean, we need to, you know, kind of test that as we go over time into the new program, but the focus of the APDP is, first of all, higher volumes, higher assembly volumes, greater economies of scale, and more localization of components in a range of areas. So that's the strategic thrust of the auto program going forward. I think the minister responded very comprehensively to the situation with clothing. If I turn into the question by the chair about polymers, a general observation about the shift in emphasis in the industrial policy is to say that, you know, we've inherited these large capital-intensive resource processing industries, like, for instance, petrochemicals and so on, and steel, and the relative shift is increased value addition and labour intensity in the more downstream sectors. In the South African economy, just to take a step back, polymers are really they're the building blocks of plastics products. So they're what goes into plastics fabrication. And one of the key areas that we want to promote in our industrial policy is plastics fabrication. It's one of these medium technology industries where there's a very strong complementarity between investment and employment. So in other words, the more you invest in plastics, the more employment you get. It's not a labor displacing sector. There's a lot of complementarity. In South Africa, the bulk of polymers are produced by Sasol through this coal-to-oil technology, some of which goes obviously into oil, a lot of which goes into producing chemical products like polymers. There are also other companies which produce polymers, but Sasol produces largely polypropylene. I think another large company called Afripol, which produces polyethylene. The key issues here and the constraints to increasing plastics fabrication are, first, pricing. Polymers are priced like other intermediate commodities on an import parity basis. So that's a big challenge. One of the things that kept polymer prices higher than they might have been, even in the presence of import parity pricing, is an import duty on polymers. And ITAC has recently, there's a decision that's been made to lower the import duties on the 10% import duty on polymers. So this will provide a little bit, some relief to plastics fabricators. The other side of it is to find areas of demand for plastic products. And here again, there's a strong linkage with the automotive sector, because the automotive sector is a strong, there are a lot of plastics products which go into a car. So we want to explore ways that we can increase plastics fabrication into the auto sector. There are other applications that we want to look at as well, like in packaging and so on. So that's kind of the general direction. I think the last question was around Apport. From Honourable Member Jikalala, the Apport is it's a capacity building program. And its full name is the African Program on Rethinking Development Economics. It's an annual program which we've been running now for 3 years, which brings out some of the best development economists in the world, and is essentially a winter school for young policymakers, academics, government officials. We also include, for instance, trade unionists. And we think it's been a very successful program in, as we say, rethinking our approach to economic development issues.
Well, thanks, Chair. I'll deal with the financial issues, and I'll go to page 236 and probably 237. With respect to the unauthorized expenditure, firstly, you'll note that that unauthorized expenditure had been incurred in the year 2003 and 4. And it sits in our books until SCOPA regularizes the unauthorized expenditure. And it largely relates to an incentive scheme that we had at the department some 10 years ago. And what the department had done at that time is that they identified that there were certain firms that probably had incorrectly claimed or fraudulently claimed. So we go through a process in trying to recover those funds. We can't recover it, we have to write it off. Now, you cannot budget for something like that. So at the time when those funds were written off, there wasn't a budget available. And it is largely the GAIS schemes and the IMIA schemes. You'll see there's also in the books 207 million rand in respect of those schemes. So sometime in the future, we still probably either recover those monies or write it off. And you'll probably find unauthorized expenditure coming through in future years. But it's a managed process. It's not somebody just going out there and incurring unauthorized expenditure without it being managed. Then with respect to the fruitless and wasteful expenditure, and you'll see it's not a large sum of money, it's 86,000 rand. I mean, in some people's books, that might be a large sum of money, but in terms of the activities that the department undertake, it's not large. Now, let me just put that into context. If we have a legitimate conference and we invite international delegates, and sometimes we bear some of those costs, and if that international delegate doesn't turn up, we have to pay that expenditure. If an official, for example, has to go somewhere and then at the last minute his activities are diverted for some important reason, we might have to still be a part of those costs. And it doesn't happen regularly. And the fact that it is in the books here, it means that we have strict controls in the department to be able to identify those and record it in the books. Then just one last thing on the audit report, and I thought maybe I should mention this, is that you find that the fundamentals in the department are in place in terms of controls. Now what the auditors are looking for is the technical issues that they can raise in the report. But with all respect to all of those issues that they raise, we immediately put systems in place to make sure that we address that. And we're on a continuous path of improvement in terms of financial management in the department. And I think the department as a whole has taken this matter very seriously, and that is why we have an unqualified audit report. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. I just need to respond to the question that has been raised by Honourable Mabasa in relation to consumer protection. I think the statement that is made, Honourable Member, is very true, that we cannot leave consumer protection to the wisdom of consumers. And I think it's for that reason that last year we piloted the Consumer Protection Bill through this committee, which has now been passed into law by the President in April. And this will come into force next year in 2010, and this is going to protect the consumer sufficiently. And our focus as the department is not really to enhance individual consumer protection only, but it's largely to give the confidence, you know, to consumers in our market. Because what we find is that consumer issues take the back seat all the time. But then when the markets are not doing very well, then people start realizing that because consumers do not play their role in the market, consumers do not buy because they are either not confident in the market or because they don't trust certain products and all of that. And that basically says to us, yes, consumers drive the economy. Consumers drive the market. And consumers drive competitiveness in the market. And so I think what is going to be important next year is that as soon as we start implementing this law, people will start realizing the truth about the importance of consumers and start appreciating it and start realizing why in some countries consumers are king, but in South Africa consumers are servants basically. They always take the last part of the piece of the meat or cake, whatever it is. So in the Consumer Protection Act that is currently in place, that is going to be implemented next year, you'll find that there are a number of issues that are very important to our economy, and that will boost the confidence of consumers and the confidence of our market and businesses. That relates to issues of product quality. There are provisions that relate to product recalls where products are not safe. We've got provisions that are going to cover that, and we've got issues relating to product labeling, to disclose to consumers certain ingredients which may not necessarily be things that are currently happening. And we also have provisions that deal specifically with trade descriptions that will also go a long way in addressing some of the issues relating to textile products that come into the country, which are of poor quality, which affect the competitiveness of some of the companies that we have in the country. And also we've got provisions that deal with unfair contract terms, which is going to bring about a different way of doing business in the country. Your standard terms of contract are going to change to align to the Consumer Protection Act, and that is going to go a long way again in giving the confidence to the consumer, because as we stand right now, consumers get screwed up all the time, not because they don't read the contract, but because the terms are not changeable, they are given to them, they have no option. And also that then is linked up with the nature of the industries that we have, the nature of the markets that we have, where you find a lot of monopolies, where you find few players, where consumers do not have options. So they've got to deal with what they get, and they cannot negotiate. So this is going to go a long way to actually make business change the way they do business with the consumers. And so I think, Honorable Mama, so you can find confidence that as from next year, I think as much as consumer issues have taken a back seat, I think this time around we'll lead from the back and we'll make some strides in doing that. And the last part that I just want to talk about is just to add to what the Minister has said about the issue of gambling. I think Prof. Turok will recall that the policy of the department has been very clear that in relation to gambling, as a country, we're not looking to generate revenue from gambling. It's not a revenue stream for us. That's not the intention. The intention of bringing regulation into gambling was to curb the scourge of illegal gambling that was taking place in the country, and that we need to put in some controls to ensure that we regulate it, but also in regulating it to ensure that the people that offer the gambling activities also take responsibility for the harm that this activity has on the public. And that is what we have currently. But yes, we have experienced that there are certain gaps in the legislation which allow for new gambling activities to be introduced because of loopholes in the legislation, and that's exactly what the Minister is looking into right now with the impact assessment. And once that impact assessment is out, and then we can then recommend and put some recommendations to this committee in terms of how we see it going forward, in terms of what policy interventions do we need to put in place, and how do we deal with aspects of the proliferation that we see. Because then the proliferation means that we are overextending gambling, and also in relation to making it too accessible to a number of people, and especially people that are poor, who may not actually be affording the gambling activities, but they may be addicted. So we want to also control that. So the impact assessment is that it's going to ensure that as a department, we then come up with a policy statement that would say whether actually we need to restrict gambling even further, or whether we need to take another drastic measure to deal with the gambling activities in the country. Thank you very much.
Chair, I wonder if I might just add a little on that point, just to elaborate. The key justification that the people who come here make is that, A, this is revenue for government, which you've just explained. B, that is job creation, and C, that is BE positive. And it seems to me that any statement the department makes should discount and say, if we allow gambling, it's because it's there, etc., etc. But those three justifications cannot be acceptable.
Minister.
Well, I mean, let me say on this that I think what would help a lot, because there's a debate. Let us hear in some kind of structured way what is the voice of the committee and the voice of Parliament, not just an anecdote of you have heard people. Why don't you then give us a report and some recommendations? Let us think about that. Let us take those into account. Because I think that it is the case that I think Zodwa has accurately captured the view of the department and the ministry. But, of course, for provinces, there are quite often other views in provinces. And they are driven by this sense of revenue and so on and so forth.
And you may be surprised. I was a bit surprised. You see the level of skills of people that are working in gambling boards. I'm surprised. You know, I thought these are top cadres that should be working on industrial development or something. They're all in gambling boards in provincial administration. And it's because it's seen as achieving exactly what Professor Turok said. Now, we've got to achieve those balances and everything. So let us hear the voice of Parliament in this whole thing. Not just an anecdote here and there or a couple of points in a question, but let's hear the committee tell us, we have heard the following people, this is our considered view, and then we can take it into account.
Yes, I was about to say something there myself, but I also noted the Honourable Marais, that perhaps just before that, I mean, we're busy with two or three processes at the moment, and the reports as such on those two or three processes of oversight have not yet been completed. I think the points are relevant that the Honourable Turok has made, but at this particular stage our report is not completed. But it would be nice to hear a different tune. I think that's really what he's saying. You know, it's the same point over and over again. Honourable Marais.
Thank you, Chair. Just to start off, I want to compliment the Minister. Your responses was probably the most comprehensive I've ever received on these issues. So really, this, thank you very much for that, and for Nimrod as well. I think that is very enlightening, so thank you very much for that. Secondly, also in terms of the auditor's report, congratulations from my side as well, because I think with the exception of a few cases, the DTI is doing very well. And I must admit that I'm actually very proud to be associated with the department and a ministry like this. So I count myself very privileged. Then just two issues that I've picked up from the slides that I would just like more clarity or more information on. The first one is on the illegal imports task team that was established in December of last year. If you can give us some information on or some feeling on the successes, but obviously also relative to the magnitude of the problem. So if you can give us some information on that, it'll be wonderful. Then in terms of the tax incentive packages that you have mentioned, obviously, I know that any tax incentive package is taking away revenue from the state. And obviously, with the current economic conditions, Treasury will be and SARS will be very, very, very probably drive a hard bargain in that regard. What are your plans? What is your intentions? I mean, I haven't got information with regards to that, so it's very difficult for me to apply my mind in terms of, you know, what is it that we are talking about, and is that substantial, or will that really contribute? Thank you very much. Madam Chair, just the last point on the disabled that you've employed. My absolute congratulations on that. I mean, that's a passion of mine. I feel very, very strongly about that. The one thing that the Minister has mentioned, and that I've got a huge issue with other departments, and that is that it seems like sometimes people feel that people with a disability is good enough in a more minor jobs levels. And what the minister has said, and that is what my experience is, you must look at the abilities of the disabled. And they are extremely, extremely knowledge and skills and abilities. And they are normally incredibly job loyal. So I can just encourage that, and if this department is leading the way in government, that will make me even more proud. Thank you.
I just wanted to point out before I took the Honourable Mandelaar-Thaysen and the Honourable Khadebe, I'm not sure if the Honourable Khadebe's hand was up, the Honourable Tikalana, that the co-op's question was not responded to from the last round. And I think the Honourable Mabasa is looking for a comprehensive response. And so we may have a situation where we do run out of time, obviously, but I would certainly like to see the questions all noted, and that one is. Before we move on, at this time now,
I am going to appeal to the honourable members to leave the comments out, save it for the debate. In due course, Honourable Van der Westhuizen, Honourable Dikalana, Honourable Khadebe, Honourable Mabaso.
Thank you. Chairperson, back to the annual report. I'm extremely concerned, although there's been great progress, on the 18% vacancy rate in the department. It's just incredible. You know, where I come from, I can't think that one-fifth of all the classes of an educational institution must be sitting outside in the sun because there's no staff to service them. And I want to know, what are your plans in this regard? And secondly, there are some reasons given in here which I, quite frankly, find very strange. On page 156, it says, and the reason for vacancies not advertised within 6 months, and it says, reason for not having complied with the filling of funded vacant SMS advertised posts. The first one given is, due to the nature of senior management work, which requires extensive international traveling, the process of finalizing the recruitment process can take longer than 6 months. I find that reason, in the day and age with communication, certainly people traveling abroad are not cut off from the DTI campus. Then, a little bit lower on the same page, it says, unavailability of funds also contributed to the no filling and advertising of positions. But the heading says, these are funded posts. So please, it needs some clarification in my mind. Also, I'm concerned that if you are running at just over 80% of your staff complement and you're just 1% within your budget, perhaps there is some truth in this reason of keeping posts vacant because there's no funds. But it just seems to me not clear and unacceptable, quite frankly. Then another thing which has been quite in the news lately is also in other state departments and entities is the whole issue of staff intimidation. And I'm extremely concerned about reports that I've received in this year of staff that have appealed to the Director General to protect them in terms of Protected Disclosures Act, etc., and that they still feel harassed and that the cases have not been attended to. There's been a case last week of somebody who's been suspended at Cipro for apparently sharing information to the police. Now, I would like to know, is this something that's endorsed by the department? Do you try and encourage a culture or an atmosphere where people who believe that there are risks for the organization, that there are irregularities, that they will be able to feel free to share that information? And if you do that, what are your actions in that regard? Thank you.
Honorable Gekalana.
Thanks, Chair. Someone was also in the last term. I think the last term, the vacancy rate was slightly higher. Yes, it's coming down. Maybe my question is from a different angle. What is the core problem? What exactly is making it, you know, the vacancy rate to go down so slowly? You know, I'm asking it from an experiential angle because I know the department has really been trying very seriously to bring it down, you know. Chair, I don't think my question on cash injections for FDI was comprehensively answered. I know financial concerns were referred to, but it was, I don't know, you know, maybe. Also, I feel that there should be a bold drive on that. In fact, I would like to link that up with what Minister Davis had said on some stage that at the beginning of us interacting around the responding to the current global economic crisis, that of a dual strategy, that one component is a defensive strategy that is defending the existing jobs, but the other one is actually offensive, that they're boldly moving into higher levels of economy. I don't know whether Mr. Davis is still maintaining that position. I thought there would have been more coming out in form of that strategy. It links up with this consistency from me. My question is loaded. Let me confess, Chair, because I maintain strongly that we should take up the offensive component very, very boldly, but obviously cautiously and prudently. But I feel that our agencies, some of them, are well-posed. Over and above IDC, let me be also fairly open. Over and above IDC, I think some are either potentially or adequately posed for that, you know, cash injection with the strong concomitant link of consolidated performance management systems in any case. The PT, Professor Turok, is not in. Because my other question was that, to what extent do we see NIPF and EPAP addressing the effort to restructure the economy? Because the issue of restructuring the economy has been coming up fairly strongly recently in various debates. On HR, I really also concur with the Honorable Van der Westhuizen. In fact, my question was much more around what I saw in page 122, whereabout I was very keen to know the resignation patterns, particularly at senior management level, you know. But obviously, I'll take you from whatever answer comes to him. Has there been any impact on internal training? Because I know DTI has been, you know, going on internal training admirably for some time, but it would be nice to share that. Unfortunately, page 148 and 149, zero on learnership.
You have put a number of questions together for the department. That was not on here, the ones, because I do want us to move on.
Okay, let me rush then.
Yeah.
That's the learnership, the zero. And any long-term studying? Now, just last to check. One, the 30-day payment cycle which DTI was assigned to handle to reduce for SMMEs, what has been the progress, Chair? Very interesting area. And also, unfortunately, Chair, Cipro has not been able to come to us. One of the most interesting things one is keen on was one works on the ground. Is the extent to which Cyprus has been able to set up its national footprint such that someone is able to register a company as close as possible, because I know that they were going to you know, have an arrangement with the post office. Chair, I know it's a long shot, but I'm just taking the advantage that the chair is around. Thank you.
Thank you.
I must concur also with the Honorable Marais on the disability area that really DTI may be stepping the trend. Thanks, sir.
Honorable Khadebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think part of the work of DTI is to help the growth of rural areas, that rural development, particularly in coming to the agricultural access to the market. So we know that we have a complaint with the Americas and Europe about their subsidies to the farmers. But to keep example, America has got its AGOA, the Africa Opportunity Land Growth and Opportunity Act. How many of our small and medium farmers did they able to use that act in order to grow their export? And then when coming to the continent also, because we are for the integration of the African economy, how in the other countries, how are they performing when coming to the issue of using this opportunity which is available to us? And then the other issue will be the issue of Eskom again. We won project in Koka. We seen that it was a great opportunity cost for us to have lost that thing. So was there any study done because of this irregular supply of electricity? How many projects did we lose in the country? In the process, how much did we lose in the economy in terms of money and job opportunities which would have been created if there was a stable supply of electricity?
Thank you, Honorable Khadebe. Honorable Mabasa.
Thank you, Comic Chair. Well, the first one is just a comment that I take it that when we make some comments to the department, even if they sound a bit harsh or criticizing. I take it that you take it as a way of pushing you to the limit. So that, you know, the answers should not necessarily be a defending answer that says no goal must come in. Because if you do so, it means you may not improve because you will give us the same answer next time. But I just want to comment on this in passing, not that, but just to follow up on my statement. On wasteful expenditure, you know, we know the answer. It's a perfect answer. But probably in that wasteful expenditure, there must be something that's a real wasteful expenditure. But if you want to contest that no, nothing is a wasteful expenditure, then it means you're not going to reduce that, not easily. But that was a comment there. Then my question is, noting that one of our main strategic objectives is the promotion of broader participation, equity, and redress in the economy. And also noting that we ourselves, as South Africa, we are this country of so unequal. I take it that we are together in assuming that there are certain parts of the country where nothing is going to happen. In other words, you are not going to get a proposal from certain parts of the country where they will say, assist us here. We have a duty to go all over the country. Very difficult, but assist the people to explore and identify opportunities so that together with them we then say, what about doing this? You know, we will also try, but I thought if I could get a comment on that, whether there is a strategy to achieve that. Then the other one is on the training institutions. Universities, technicons, to what degree do we move with them in terms of them producing the skills that we need as a country? Is there no danger that they are just setting their objectives and the real world is setting its objectives, and if there is no crossing of those two paths, then, you know, we may find, because it will be painful if 15 years down the line we find we don't have boiler makers, we don't have plumbers. How will we explain that? You know, it's and if we don't consciously produce that, it may not happen. Then the last one was on the relationship between DTI and departments like agriculture. I'm saying this, if we look at the rural areas, I will assume that there's a role, the major role is for agriculture and water, you know, etc. But I also assume that there must be a role for DTI. So, for an example, in Botswana, if I'm not making a mistake, there is this approach of financing tractors, or where you find that the communities is relying on government to assist on certain instruments of farming. Thanks, Colleague Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Mabasa. One or two questions I have, and I do know we had a commitment to complete this at 11:30, but nevertheless, we've never operated mechanically here, a very organic approach. So we can just look at Sarwin. Somewhere here, I think it was 34. Sarwin, yes. It spoke about work on stabilizing the South African Women's Entrepreneurs Network, and the strategy behind it is being reviewed. clearly perhaps some challenges were identified, and there's an indication when this has been done, and if it's too long a question to answer, I'm sure we're going to be putting that in writing as well. The other one was on the sector interventions, I think on page 17, business processing outsourcing. The point made, which is very heartening, 17 applications is approved and will create 18,000 jobs. Were we looking at the will being over a period of 6 months, a year, 2 years? What kind of projections were in place there? And then the just perhaps the last one of the last points from myself, page 60. When I say page, I mean slide. I should effectively say slide. The minister, I think you referred to the risk of the illegal, goods and the clothing and textiles and that kind of thing, and a task team being set up in the department. And my question then would be, what's your relationship in doing this with SARS, who I know also has some form of task team or division in that regard? And then we heard at some point, and it is in the annual report, I just can't find it, there was a reference, of course, to, I'm sure I haven't got the name right, but it's the insurance that covers exports as they go out and so on, and some of the challenges that were being experienced and that this was going to be addressed. I wonder if you would share with this committee what kind of timeframes were in the offing to address this. Thank you, Minister. And may I add that obviously you're welcome to try and answer all of them, but if time becomes against us, we will then have to indicate that we'd respond to this. My appeal would be to get the co-ops answered first.
Okay, thanks. I'll take the co-ops question. I'll take the illegal imports. I'll talk about the tax incentives. I want to talk about the Cipro and the intimidation that you allege. I'll talk about the DFI's cash injection, the restructuring of the economy. I want to talk a little bit about human resource and training issues, and then agriculture and the Goa. Those are the things I'll deal with, and the other colleagues should come in and add even. Just to say, the illegal imports task team is, first of all, it's not a DTI thing. It's a joint initiative, and obviously SARS is a major player in that. I think that maybe Nimrod can give further details on some of the successes, but I think one of the very striking figures that indicated to me the need for this was that there is a presentation we gave to NEDLAC some time ago. There is a 60% difference between the declared value of exports of clothing products from China to South Africa and then the value which they enter our port at. I mean, there's a 60% difference. There is under-invoicing on an absolutely massive scale. And the effect of the tariff which we have in place is consequently undermined to a very large extent. Along with that, there's very significant brand fraud and all sorts of things like this. Now, this is happening on a scale which doesn't mean it's somebody who's in a flea market. This is organized crime. Let's put it that bluntly. Call it what it is, organized crime. And so what's happened is that task team is trying to address this matter. It has had some successes. There have been some arrests. One of the big problems is that a number of the big importers act through agents. And they say, well, I know what that happens, the agent's problem. And that's a matter which we are looking at as well. Then on the...
I think that would also go for the labor broker. Yeah.
Well,
where they would say, no, it's not our problem, it's the labor broker.
Yeah, I don't know. The illegal import brokers are probably just... but now what we... on the second one, the tax incentives.
Look, I think that, you know, there is obviously ongoing discussion with Treasury on budgeting matters. And, of course, we have to go along there. We have to argue for all the different tax incentives, the value that we get from them. We have to show that and demonstrate that, and it's right that we have to do that. But I just want to say that what we do in many of these investments, and why we have a suite of investments, we have all kinds of incentive schemes. Some in on budget, some off budget, some tax concessions, some grants. What's very useful is when you have a bigger investment, is you know you can customize it. Have a bit of this, have a bit of that, have a bit of the other one. Then they get a package, and that encourages the investment. That's what we need. So I think many of those, I would argue, many of those projects, many of those incentive schemes, many of those tax incentives have yielded results. But you know, there's an ongoing review. We have to review these. We review them internally. We have to discuss them with the Treasury. There's an ongoing review of those all the time. On the co-ops, let me just say on the co-ops, I think I'll obviously let Sipo add to this, but the co-ops, one of the things that is an important decision which we've taken, in line actually with our manifesto commitment, is we are no longer treating co-ops as small businesses. It's co-ops is a different form of enterprise. In some countries, co-ops are big. In Spain, the Mondragon is a huge. In Cyprus, the biggest bank is a co-op bank. So it's not a subdivision of small business. Many of them in South Africa are in fact small businesses, small. But the reality is that we need co-op specific programs in place. There is a policy framework which is under discussion in NEDLAC, which is talking about agencies, co-op agencies, and specific co-op support programs. I think that within the spirit of what the Honourable Mabasa said, I don't want to say that everything we're doing is fine, that these inquiries and discussions are actually with a view to trying to improve our work. I would say that we have a lot of improvement to do in terms of our support for co-ops in the DTI, and we're working along those lines. And I think it's very important that we work in collaboration with the practitioners and through the NEDLAC process. But that's what we're doing on co-ops, but I think Sipo can add to that. On the vacancy rate, well, I think we should just take note that this is the report for last year. I would be very worried myself if I saw that the vacancy rate this year was 18% as well. We want to see that vacancy rate going down. I think there are lots and lots of things that are happening there. And that can be that people find better alternatives in the private sector. I think you find that I used to hand out the 15-year and 20-year awards, and I saw who was I giving them to? It's the clerks and the cleaners. I mean, nobody in the senior management has stayed for that long. You know, that's the reality of the public sector in general. But I think there's a number of things which we're doing. I think what we really need to do is we can't compete with the private sector on the basis of the salary package. I mean, because we have to try to do that to some degree. But it's basically the quality of the work that you do. That's what it is. And I think that some of the work, I mean, for example, some of the recruitments which we have managed to achieve recently and which we've been prioritizing are to fill the industrial policy sectors. You know, the DDG and then a number of the chief director's positions have been filled. We've been prioritizing that. Obviously, because industrial policy is our lead program. So we've been prioritizing that, and I think we've achieved some successes. But what are we noticing, is that we are often fishing in the same pool as economic development, fishing in the same pool as all the other government departments. You know, so people are hopping from one job to another. And what we really need to do is what somebody said, and that is to grow the pool. Training is critical. I am of the view that when you look around at the economics departments and what they teach, the people that come out of that would not actually be equipped, neither would they think that their future lies in doing industrial policy work in the DTI. That's not a career option. It's to go work in a bank or something, a financial economist or something like that. That is the kind of perspective. So we have started a piece of work, and Sarah can talk a little bit more about that.
about we want to try to do an internship program in the DTI itself to grow the pool of people doing industrial policy work. Some theory, some practical work. I think you can see similar schemes in other departments, like the DIRCOT, Department of International Relations Corporation, has got an internship scheme, a combination of actual work with some universities involved and actual on the job training. That kind of stuff, we want to move in that direction. Also, I've been promising my colleague, Minister of Higher Education, Comrade Bladen Zimbani, that we will come to him with some observations about economics course teaching. I think this is where Nimrod's point about a port comes in. We just lost that kind of real economy focus in a lot of our economic courses. So I think this is a very big issue, and it's something which we want to address. On the allegation of staff intimidation at CIPRA, I want to make a broader point. First of all, there have been two levels of allegations about CIPRA. One of them has been about the tender for the ICT. Well, the Auditor General gave it a clean bill of health, and I don't know what I can say about that. But there are also a broader set.
Sorry, Chair, I was just informed before this meeting that the Auditor General's report has not yet been received.
Let me just clarify that. There was an.
Well, I wonder. I want to say one thing is that we are aware of a series of allegations about problems within CIPRA. We have become made aware of that. And we have taken a decision and the work has started. We are putting in place a full forensic investigation into the affairs of CIPRA to address all of those matters, all of those complaints that have been referred to different people and so on. At this stage in time, I don't know where that investigation is going to take us, but we have taken that decision and that work is underway. On the question of the cash injection to DFIs. You said FDI. I think you meant DFIs. That is what I said. I said that we will come up with some proposals in the IPAP. I mean, I don't really want to go into all the details now, but we will financing for industrial development. And I think there similar points can be made about financing for small business development. But we are looking at enlarging the capacity of DFIs to play that role. I mean, concessional funding for industrial development, this is what every other developing country is doing. If we don't do it, it's not going to happen. And I think that's the so we are looking at that. Do I still think that we are defensive and offensive? Well, yes, we are. We're trying to defend jobs. The crisis response is about defending jobs. But I think what we're trying to do is have an articulation between the two. So the way we defend jobs and defend industrial capacity also builds on our longer-term approach towards creating new industrial capacity in the country and enlarging jobs. That's what it's about. It's about that link between the two. And yes, indeed, the IPAP is about a process of beginning to address the structural issues in the economy and to shift us onto a new growth trajectory. Will the next IPAP be the full blueprint of that? No, it won't. But it'll be higher impact than the current one, and I think we'll be moving progressively in that direction as we move forward. On the question of AGOA, let me just say that like many of these market access arrangements, the least generous market access, be it through the TDCA or be it through AGOA, is actually for agricultural products. When you're talking about developed countries of the north, that is the reality. I can't give you figures offhand about participation of small farmers, but I'll give you an example that I do know from this. Is for example, we have access duty-free access into the U.S. under AGOA for canned pears, but we produce many more canned peaches. And we repeatedly asked them, can we have canned peaches as well? And, of course, there are two states in the United States that are known as peach states, and so we don't get it. There's that sort of reality around that. The broader question of AGOA and Africa is that many African countries export into the United States only really what the United States calls apparel, what we call clothing. That's the only major thing which they use a goa for. We have a more diversified product base because we have a different kind of economy. But it has been quite significant in terms of expanding African exports into the United States, albeit in many cases it's too much of a single product for many countries. I think that our message on the goa, which I conveyed when I went to the United States a few months ago, in all kinds of forums, the USTR and Congress, various think tanks and so on, is we are actually arguing, and I think we're going to get in a hearing, is that the United States, we are urging for there to be a reasonable rollover of a goa as it currently stands, rather than an attempt to try to recraft the goa along the lines of the EPAs. And I think we're warning the United States that there are many, many difficulties with the EPAs, and they probably would be well advised not to try to follow that route. So we are proposing that there should be a rollover for a reasonable period of time of a goa as it currently stands. And then our links with the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, well, there's a number of interactions we have with them. But very, very critically, in terms of industrial policy, is that one of our focus areas as we move further forward is going to be on agro-industries. And, of course, agro-industries requires that we don't have a silo between ourselves and agriculture, and also mariculture, for that matter, which is fisheries. Yes, we are working with them, and on many of the trade issues, we work very closely with them as well. Yes, we are. They're part of our cluster. And so on. I think that's all I will say at this point, and let the colleagues take over. Thanks.
Thanks. Just to add on the co-op percentages of budget compared to the whole of DTI. Really, if you look at the allocation that we have for the co-ops, it's a small amount. But that kind of allocation is for a specific a process within the development of the co-ops, you know, for the startups, where we give them between, 0 to about 300,000 just for them to form themselves, to start and organize themselves. But if you take the support that is also provided by the DFIs of the DTI, like IDC, SAMAF, COOLA, they also support the co-ops movement. By the time these things are not recorded in terms of separating the exact amount that went to the co-ops and all these things, but we can provide the overall picture if you want us to do that. we can provide that kind of information. Maybe then go to the next round of questions, if I may be allowed to chair. The 30-day payment cycle, what we have done on this one, through CEDA, we have launched a call center where the suppliers to government could call if they didn't receive the payment within 30 days. This was launched by the minister, I think, in September. We are also working very closely with the National Treasury to make this part of the performance agreement of the heads of the departments, so that when they are, the performance assessed at the end of the year, this is taken care of in terms of the departments and the provinces' compliance with the 30-day payment cycle. And yes, again, about assisting poor regions to access economic opportunities. Again, this is really in line with part of the new vision or the strategy of the department. Well, we did mention briefly that we are going into regions, mapping up economic clusters, and developing a bankable project. After doing that, we will then bring the DFIs of government and commercial banks, you know, even the non-financial institutions, to also try to help the entrepreneurs in those regions that have been in those regions where these programs would have been developed. But it's a new program that we are still putting together, and we'll be discussing this evening or this afternoon. The SAWEN, the strategy review from the chair. Yes, we are rearranging SAWEN institutionally now. Chair, I'm answering one of the SAWEN question on SAWEN. We are rearranging SAWEN institutionally because in the past, SAWEN. In the past, SAWEN, you know, was led by a so-called Section 21 that was not even registered with the National Treasury as an agent of DTI. So it was a group of women who established this Section 21, and they were assisted by DTI because it's a good networking forum for potential entrepreneurs. But we are trying now to rearrange that because they are not working optimally with the provincial leg of SAWEN. So yes, institutionally we are rearranging, and then the focus itself now in terms of what would be the focus of SAWEN and what is it that this SAWEN thing is supposed to be doing to assist women develop economically and otherwise. So we hope by the end of this financial year, we'll be able to have a strategy that we can also present here. That will cover my side. Thank
you. Just briefly, Chair, clothing and textiles, just a kind of indication of progress. For instance, in September, SARS seized about 400 tons of clothing products in Durban, estimated to be valued at 60 million rand. I don't know whether that was the under invoiced value or the true value, but and they also raided a number of stores and closed down about 47 stores that couldn't provide proper proof of import documentation. And they also seized other goods, abalone, counterfeit DVDs, and so on. In terms of taking this work forward, I think what we're trying to do is just tie down the modalities between ourselves and SARS to also improve the reporting on an ongoing basis, because I think the question of what is the progress relative to the size of the problem is a very important question. Then there was the question about the impact of electricity cuts. Obviously, we haven't had load shedding now for quite some time, but work that was done at the time indicated that the worst possible impact on the economy would be not to have electricity being provided to firms. Going forward, we obviously know that that there will be a considerable impact of electricity price rises on the manufacturing sector, and we're trying to monitor and evaluate that, and also look at how should we be responding, for instance, by looking at the kind of industrial energy efficiency interventions that could be made in the industrial sector.
Yes, Chair, I'm just going to...
Just before you respond, seeing that you were adding to all the co-op issues, can you just include the figures, follow up on responding to the figures and the region. I think the Honourable Barth is very interested in the figures and the regions and not the generic comments of a small amount.
Thanks, Chair. On the co-ops, In terms of the incentive, because in our division we would look at it from an incentive perspective. Last year was the first time really that we started with a program, and we had a budget that we disbursed of 9 million rands for co-ops, and it was mostly, as Sipho indicated, intended for small co-ops and startup co-ops, not your. It provides smaller co-ops and with a grant of 300,000 in order to either acquire, improve their technological capabilities by acquiring machinery and equipment, and also providing working capital. And most of the co-ops that we have approved have been in the rural areas. I think in terms of the figures that the DG were in the presentation of the DG around agro-processing. This year, we've got a budget that is three times as much. It's still a small amount, and it's still not significant. And I think the minister has indicated that this is an area where we've got to improve significantly. We will be increasing that figure by, you know, three times this year, although starting albeit off a very low base. Then on the other issue of BPO, the 18,000 jobs, the jobs would be created over a three-year period. What happens is that companies come to us and they stay with us for a three-year period, and we monitor those jobs, and so they are able to claim the incentives that are on offer based on them achieving the targets regarding jobs. Thanks, Josh.
Tumelo, do you want to deal with the Alken Rio team to ESCO? I think it arose.
Okay, Chair. Yes, obviously, the investment at Kuha was going to be about 21 billion rand by Alken for a new aluminium smelter, and in order to establish as is the case with most companies that produce aluminium, Alken had been offered a long-term contract by Eskom over, I think, a 25-year contract with Eskom, because Alken required certainty of electricity supply over that period. And starting last year, when the problems regarding electricity emerged, that there was a team that was set up between ourselves and the Department of Public Enterprises to see as to whether we could extend the time frame for the project. And we did quite a lot of work, but it became clear there were certain contractual commitments where parties had to act this year. Either Alken had to begin building the smelter, and so forth. So, given that it's not yet clear in terms of Eskom's power supply going forward, it was decided that maybe it might be useful at this point in time.
Right. What we're going to do, that is a question I would like fully responded to.
Okay.
I just don't think you've got enough time to do all of it right now. So if you could just turn that mic off and just to indicate to the minister where time is almost running against us at this point.
I just want to say on that very quickly that, in fact, Kuha has already factored in the need to make a change of strategy, that we can no longer rely on these high energy intensive anchor projects to run these IDZs. So they've already made that shift. And there's a whole lot of other projects, the refinery being one of the main ones that are taking over. But I think that's the reality, that we can't, for the foreseeable future, and at least until some of the big investments come on. We can't be offering very large, energy-intensive projects, which actually have a fairly small labor absorption capacity. We can't be going this route. We need to go a different route, and I think that's what happened. But it's no crisis for Kucha. I don't think it's any crisis for development in the Eastern Cape or anything like that. It's unfortunate that we can't provide the wherewithal to make a project like that happen.
Minister, I in fact wished we'd allocated a day. It's just most unfortunate that we are reaching a time where I don't want responses cut short. You know, I really do want the full response, notwithstanding that this report is 2008-2009, the annual report. But clearly, it was a time when, it was, as we came back to the fourth parliament and so on, that a shift, a need to have a bit of a shift was identified. And certainly the annual report in the light of that would also, as you respond in writing, if that could be taken into account. There are still several questions that are outstanding. Am I correct, members? I'm just looking at you. And certainly I will ask members, there were two or three that were fully responded to, let's be honest, and others were not. Now, I would like you to see the committee secretary there, because this has got to be done this afternoon, you know, in terms of writing them down. We already have about 15, 16, 20 questions here. So I think it would be unfair to now start reading them out and prolonging this session. We will ask our committee section, the support staff, just to electronically mail this to the DG, Mr. Matona. And it does seem as if you're under tremendous pressure, and I certainly apologize about the inconvenience caused to you and your department and the department minister for the delay in this particular important meeting. But if we could just once again appeal to you that having got received these questions, either taking them now on these sort of handwritten stuff or being emailed before three, you will be able to respond by Monday 2 p.m. I'm just looking at the DG as well as the minister. That's right. Well, some of them may well require papers, but what we're looking for is a concise response, but still comprehensive.
We will endeavor.
And I think so far we've had that kind of relationship where you have a pretty good idea as to what we're asking. Because we're looking at the time, it's 1 o'clock here, and we're just about that, and regrettably administration would require the room at 1 o'clock, so it makes it somewhat difficult to proceed any longer. But Minister, I'm looking at yourself as to if there's anything else that you would like to share with us here at this particular meeting.
No, I don't want to keep you here till 2 o'clock. I think we've probably covered it all. I think just to say that.
Ask members to sit down, please.
I just wanted to say, really, that I think that members have raised a number of very relevant questions, and I think the spirit that we want to present the annual report is not to be sit here and be defensive, but to work with you to try to identify ways that we can improve our work. That's what we're on about. So I think thanks for those. We'll try to respond to the questions as much as we can. I think it's been a useful opportunity to use the report of the past to actually discuss a whole lot of matters as we're working now and as we're moving forward. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
I may make a personal appeal to you on the legal goods task team and the work done there and challenges and what has been achieved. I think this is an important point that you could perhaps expand on in writing to us. And I say this because of the huge challenges the clothing and textile industry is facing. And it would enable us to have a better understanding of that. But really, Minister, you know, being the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry, it's a very constructive relationship that you have underpinned with the department, with us, as we continue to converse. And as we come to the end of an annual year, let me say here in committee that we really appreciate the orientation sessions you've given us, the workshops, and indeed this has enabled us to more constructively engage in our oversight. We couldn't have done this otherwise. But I think that we're still on a very sharp learning curve. Your mandate in trade and industry is very large. So many of us didn't realize how large it was and is. And so we are still trying to get a handle on it to do our own work more successfully in this regard. But thank you to the individual members here. And as the Honourable Mabaso has said, and other members sitting here, Honourable Members, I think whatever we're saying here, because we know in the final analysis we have an obligation to the people of South Africa, and that is wherever, whatever our job, our focus in the Constitution and so on, it is to have one achievement, one broad overarching one, and that is to deliver services effectively and to improve the lives of all the people, especially the most vulnerable. And that it is only by both of us endeavoring to do our sides effectively that we can honestly achieve this. So I thank also the Honourable Members who put up with my lengthy statements. Thank you very much for this engagement with the department again. And also to the staff members and support staff who are working at a very pressurized pace at the moment. Thank you all, Minister. Thank you.
Can I just say, Chairperson, condolences to you for the loss of your brother-in-law. And I know that you are on your way back to attend funeral obligations and things like that. So be sure that you're in our prayers as well. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Condolences from us to